Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, June 22nd, 2020. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, last week we ended with Romans chapter 9, so I'm going to be picking up in the book of Romans, chapter 10. We're reading from the book of Romans, chapter 10. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. For I bear them record that they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believeth. For Moses described the righteousness which is of the law, that man which doeth those things shall live by them. But the righteousness which is of faith speaketh on this wise, say not in thine heart, who shall ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down from above, or who shall descend into the deep, that is to bring Christ again from the dead. But what saith it? The word is nigh thee, even in thy mouth, and in thy heart, that is the word of faith which we preach, that if thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus Christ, and shalt believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. For with the heart man believeth unto righteousness, but with the mouth confession is made unto salvation. For the Scripture saith, whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. For there is no difference between the Jew and the Greek, for the same Lord over all is rich unto all that call upon him. For whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe on him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of the good things. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah saith, Lord, who hath believed our report? So then faith come from hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not heard? Yes, truly, their sound went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the world. But I say, did not Israel know? First Moses saith, I will provoke you to jealousy by them which are no people, and by a foolish nation I will anger you. But Isaiah is very bold and saith, I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. But to Israel he saith, all day long I have stretched forth my hands unto a disobedient and gainsaying people. That is the book of Romans, chapter 10. Okay, Jen, do we have any announcements to be made? Jen, it looks like you're muted if you're talking. All right. Terry, do you know if Jan's around? Do you know if there are any questions or any announcements to be made?
Yes, I think there are. And he was here a few minutes ago. I think he's still here.
Maybe he's talking into a muted mic?
No, he looks unmuted. No, he is muted.
Yep. All right, well, if there he goes.
I didn't show as muted on my end, I guess is a problem. Yeah, there were no announcements for this week, but there are a number of questions if you want to take questions now.
Yep, we'll do questions.
Okay, the first question is from someone who is concerned about having us join with other groups. And the first one she brings up, or he, I forget which it is the Lighthouse group. You remember we talked to them about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
Which group is that?
The Lighthouse Law Group, Law Club. And the second one is Cal Washington and his In Power movement. And we talked to them maybe 3 years ago, 2 to 3 years ago. And she's wondering why we haven't joined with them. So maybe you can add.
Yeah, I don't particularly remember the specifics, and at least not by name anyway. We've talked with lots of people, lots of different groups. We've been on lots of radio programs, and we've had lots of conversations with many, many different people. So specifically, I don't recall. And Gerard, do you have any memory of any of these two particular groups? I see Gerard's here, but he's muted. You got to unmute yourself.
The same problem I had.
What, you couldn't unmute?
Yeah, I showed as being unmuted.
Yeah. All right, well, if he gets unmuted, he can maybe respond if he knows of anything. I don't particularly remember anything, but I will tell you a couple of things. We got to be very careful in who we kind of, fuse together with, if you want to use that word. I don't know that we want to fuse together with anyone. I think we need people to join in with what we're doing. I think lots of groups should be coming here to learn how to have government by consent, how to take control of the government from the grassroots level. By working with the committeemen and working with the administrators for the juries and, taking back our courts, taking back our political process, reconstructing our militia, working with the sheriff and really getting a connection across the, from sheriff to sheriff, from county to county and from state to state, all the way across the nation. And even we, the people, as individual groups. God, you got a lot of interference coming through there. But anyway, not sure where I was. I lost my place. But in any event, we have spoken to lots of people, and we do have to be careful. Oh, yeah, working across the nation. So any group that's willing to do that and that wants to come and work with us, if they are a group of people who understand the law, been involved in the courts and different things like that, well, we'd be glad to join with them as long as they can conform to our thinking, which really is 100% solid on the Constitution, on our founding fathers, on the principles of common law and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, a lot of groups that have some experience in the courts and stuff, they continue with the man on the land stuff, trying to make those arguments. And when you make those arguments, you're really giving the enemy power, because you're empowering them by acknowledging them as some kind of an authority, when in fact they are a de facto authority. They have no authority at all. They're fiction. A de facto court, a de facto, process that they go through. So we want to stay 100% focused on the common law and the going looking back into history to understand how things worked in the past, and really come to, and this is the hard part, this is the part that many people choke on, and that is that you make the law. You say what the law is. Now, of course, the law must be righteous. It must come from the heart. God said that he would put it into our hearts, so we know right from wrong. We know what the law is, but the law is whatever the people say it is. And the Declaration of Independence, we were founded upon ultimately common law. Okay, nature's God, and that is our foundation. And we have government by consent, so the government does not control us; we control them. We must have government by consent. The Constitution says, we the people ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. So we made the law. And that law particularly, it is common law, because God gave us that authority to write that law, and in order to have a government that would be under our will and not the will of any political individual or political group. Unfortunately, that's where we're at today, and we need to bring it back under the people. So when a grand jury hears a case that is brought before them, and they want to, you know, to be decided on whether they're going to get an indictment or not, well, it's the people who decide whether there was a wrongdoing or not. It's the people who decide whether they think they are looking at the right person, the right target. So again, there's the authority. If we're in a court and we have a trial jury, it's the people who decide. And they decide not just the facts, they decide the law. And they don't just decide the facts and the law, they also decide the restitution and the penalty. Usually that is usually combined. But unfortunately in our system, we have political individuals who have seized control of our courts through the Rules Enabling Act, particularly Rule 2. They abrogated common law by a rule. They abrogated the Constitution by a rule. They abrogated the Bill of Rights by a rule. They abrogated the Declaration of Independence by a rule. They abrogated the right of the people to have government by consent by a rule. They have 100% control. They control who goes to the court, who gets indicted. They get their ham sandwich. And that is a true statement. You know, these prosecutors usually get their indictments. Very rare when they don't get their indictments. But anyway, they have total control of who gets indicted. They have total control of the jury. What law is going to be applied? And there is no law that can be applied upon we the people, except the laws of nature's God. And that's common law, period. And it's the people who bring those accusations and makes that judgment innocent or guilt and decides what is the consequences. And of course, you know, from that point of view, not only the injured party benefits, but also the individual who injured that party, because restitution is part to restore that individual as well as restoring the injured party to restore that individual that did the wrongdoing. And that's where we're at today. And this is where we need to, people need to understand that we make the law. We're in charge. We have government by consent. We say yay or we say no. Through the committee man process, we can remove any person that is elected, including the President of the United States. The committee men can remove anybody from office, okay? There is a process to do that, and they could do it within 90 days. To remove someone like the president would be a really big job, and it would, you know, take a lot of people to sign up on that one. And there is a particular process that must be filed. It's not where you go to a website and just click a button and say, hey, my signature on it is on it. No, that's not how it works. There is a very specific way to remove someone or to get some kind of what's called recall. Some courts will say that, we haven't been given any statutory authority to do a recall, therefore there's no statute that permits it. Well, we're not controlled by statutes. We're controlled by the laws of nature's God. It's called common law or natural law. And the people need to understand that basic truth. And from there, that's when they can really have free minds. That's when they can really start to think free and act free and be free, when they understand what the law is. So, right, anyway, I even forgot the question, but what's next, Jan?
Okay, second question. Does the governor have the authority to delegate power over his or her constituents to a third power such as the CDC? Which overstepped into freedom of religion by demanding zero church attendance and the distancing, wearing a mask, and confinement at home?
Well, first of all, the president is pretty clear on this, and he makes the point, it's up to the people. You know, we can set off guidelines and everything, but the people, it's up to the people whether they want to wear some kind of a mask or something. And it has nothing, you know. But, of course, we got these governors who think that, first of all, that they can control the people, that they can give an executive order to the people. And this is where, again, let's get back to who makes the law, okay? Where does the governor get his authority? He gets his authority from the people. And that's a constitution. So every state has a constitution. But that constitution is also governed by the Constitution for the United States of America. And that is the main law of the land. It's called the law of the land. And so every constitution must be in agreement with that. Anything that injures or affects or anything that constitution is null and void. Okay. Now, the principle of who makes the law, the governor does not make the law. A governor could give an executive order, but that order only can go to people who are bureaucrats, anybody elected, you know, elected, appointed, or just hired by the government, or if they're involved in certain commercial activities. He can give executive orders to those individuals, but they certainly cannot give an executive order to the people. In the sense of, there's only one way they can do that, and that would be the militia. The governor has the power and the authority to call forth the militia, and when they're in the service as the militia, they're under the authority of the governor or the president, depending on who called them. And of course, then his orders need to be followed. Those people need to be following them. But as far as the people themselves, who would also make up the rest of the militia, which would be the unorganized militia, and that would only be under certain emergency situations, of course, where there is, what's going on in the streets right now. They should be calling forth the militia to deal with that problem, especially what took place over this past weekend and has been taking place over the past month or two. All these crazy, insane people just destroying things that they did not create, demanding things that they did not participate in the construction and building of, or supporting of, or understanding the law of this land, understanding the freedom and the liberties that they received from ultimately from God, but it's through our Constitution that is exercised. And they're just destructive and destroying. But in any event, the governor cannot order anyone to wear a mask. If they arrest someone, as far as I'd be concerned, that would be kidnapping. I've been thinking of suing our governor here in New York. This guy is insane. He just doesn't want to let anything go. He still has us, to some degree, you know, he still has us tied down. He's still demanding certain things and threatening of certain things. And it's destructive to what's going on. And anybody who's really paying attention, and of course any of these organizations, whatever it is, they can give us advice, but that's all it could be is advice. They can't tell us to do anything, nor can the governor force us to do those things. But look at anybody with any common sense. If I was the governor, I would tell everybody, get out. It's beautiful up here. There's a lot of sun the last few days. Beautiful weather, beautiful pool weather, beautiful weather for the beach, picnics. I would be telling people, go to the beach, go to the pool, because this virus and no virus can live through the radiation of the sun. It, within seconds, it's killed. So if someone even coughs before it would reach another person, it would be dead. But they're ignoring that fact. And, of course, there's alternative motives behind what they're doing. These are all democratic cities. And they're all under the orders of their leader, which I still believe is, generally speaking, it's still Barack Obama. But even he, beyond him, has people behind him that are controlling things, of course. And ultimately, it's the New World Order. But, they have no power, no authority to control us in any way, shape, or form. And they do control us, and people do go to jail. And they do pay the penalty, or whether it be a fine or some time in jail. And they get angry and upset, and they walk away, and that's it, because they're ignorant. I wouldn't just walk away You know, you can't prevent them. They got the guns. They could put you in jail. Or they could take your money. But you could take them to court. And again, we do have a process to deal with this. And, you know, you'll probably not win in a court. But who knows? Sometimes you can in today's environment with some of the new judges coming in. But in any event, in a court of record, even brought underneath what we're doing as a joinder, eventually, when we get to the other side, all of the actions, all of the decisions, all of the destruction and that these people have done is going to come to an end, and they're going to have to pay the price. But not until we take back the courts. But we can't take back the courts until unless the people understand the law and how powerful and authoritative they are. They have to realize that. And that's what NLA is all about. Anything to the contrary of that, of any group that we may fuse together with, maybe because they have people that are working legally, they have to conform to what we're thinking. Of course, you know, if there's something different here or there and they can make some corrections, we're open for corrections. We're not perfect. I guess that's about it. Next question.
Okay. How does common law interact with probate court in the state of Georgia? My personal details. I'm a trucker. I have a flexible schedule. I have a special needs daughter. Her name is Sydney. And now under guardianship of her mother and stepfather. Sydney is now 19, above the age of majority, and still needs the assistance of an adult, her mother. Now, Q&A, what paperwork is there to file to simply request time and visitation with my daughter? There is no reason for the restrictions that are placed on me contacting her at this time. From my research, it's all been unlawful. Later, I will file a lawsuit, but for now, I just want contact and have my daughter know that I have not forgotten her. Annabelle fighting for her rights and mine to have time together.
Right. Did he say that he was the biological father,
yeah.
Or did he say he was a stepfather?
No, he is the biological father. She's living okay. with her stepfather.
And the mother is a biological mother?
Yeah.
And I don't know if he mentioned in there, that did he mention anything about the relationship that his daughter would want to have that relationship, or is she denying that relationship? We don't
no,
know that, do we?
It sounds like the daughter would like to have a relationship okay. with her father, but it's being blocked.
Yeah, okay. Well, here's the thing, okay? What is right and what is wrong? What is just? What is just is that any child, and, you know, this person's 19, they're still kind of a kid anyway, but also it sounds like there's some special problems there. In any event, they have a right to both a mother and a father. No judge, no lawyer, nobody shall or should interfere with that right. And no one can say, well, you get 10% and we'll give 90% to this person. No, that child deserves 50-50 at bare minimum. That child deserves the right to be able to have a father and a mother and to make the decisions on where they want to be, especially at that age, more than anything else. And that really is the common law. It's common sense. It's obvious. And there's games going on. This whole thing is about keeping the battle going. You know, if the court turns around and does something like that, well, they don't have a lot to say anymore, do they? Because there's no real battle going on, and they're not going to be making their money, because what I see, it's all RICO and steroids. Probate courts and family courts are unconstitutional. They're unlawful. They cannot give due process, and you should be able to beat them in a court of law by challenging the jurisdiction. Of course, you need to know how to do that. There's a possibility you can win that in today's environment, and you could take it up the appellate process. You can win it through there, maybe, if you have to. And you can also always just move it into our court for cause at the end of the road, so to speak, where at least, you know, we have a shot at trying to push them to do the right thing. And again, if they still don't, you know, we go through a process. We'll give them first of all, we do an amicus curiae, which is a paper on behalf, in this case, of the defendant. The next thing we do after time goes on is make a decision in order. If they don't obey the decision and order, we serve them a contempt of court. And after a contempt of court, if they still don't obey, then we go for an indictment. And then we send a copy of that indictment to Attorney General Barr and the President. And of course, also we file it in our court system, file it in their courts. And we also post it up on our website. And at some point in time, justice must prevail. The people, again, it gets back to knowledge. People need to understand who they are and what authority they really have and what the law is. The law is whatever you say it is. It's whatever we say it is. And of course, the point is ultimately through a jury particularly, and whether it be a grand jury for the indictment and a trial jury for the trial. But that's what it is, and that's where it's got to get to. All of these things, if our courts were just, we wouldn't have these problems. Family court must go. We have some ideas on what could be done to assist families with problems and situations that really work without lawyers or without judges. That should be available to the people. And of course, the ruling over that authority could be through the Supreme Court. In other words, the state court, particularly in your county. That's about all that he could. He does have a right, but the mother has a right too. And they have to come together. If the state was really concerned about the family, they would send someone into the family to sit down to talk, to try to arbitrate the situation and work through things at what is right and what is wrong, and the necessity of any child deserving the right of a father as much as they do a mother, and so on. But we're not there yet, and that's where we got to get to. All right. Hey, Gerard, you want to check out your mic to see if it's working? To see you back in. But you have to click the mic to unmute yourself first.
Gerard's muted.
Yeah, I know. Looks like he fell out again.
Looks like it. He just disappeared when he said that.
Any questions? Any other questions?
We got one more, John.
One more.
I joined NLA. I am interested in applying for a jury administrator and willing to organize in my county in Michigan. Are the jury administrator positions available to fill and start receiving pay now, or is this a position that will be available in the future? I have completed 10 chapters in the government by consent course, but there seems to be no way to complete chapters 11 through 15. How can I complete this? And then is there an electronic download for the handbook for sheriffs?
So is there an electronic download for what?
The handbook for sheriffs.
Oh, sure there is. Matter of fact, it might be one on the front page, but we do know if you go to, for instance, People's Duty, come down to the county sheriff. If you look at the monitor, you'll see we're going there right now. And on the county sheriff page, here is a downloaded copy of the sheriff's handbook. Now, we're perfecting right now three handbooks. One is a jury administrative handbook for sheriffs, coroners, and administrators. And that's about a 30-page book. As soon as it's complete, we're very close to being complete. We've completed quite a bit of it. We just have a couple of things we need to research out, and once we research out and get that information together into the book, we're going to post it. The second book is a handbook specific, and again, that particular handbook is for the jury administrators, the sheriffs, and the coroner. And through research and discussing this with Brent and looking into different things and testing what Brent had discovered, and I've come to a conclusion he's absolutely right on this. An epiphany, I guess, for me anyway. And that is, no prosecutor should ever have the ability to speak to the grand jury. They're abusive. and we cover this in this administrative handbook. If a prosecutor wants to, if the government wants to get a charges against somebody, and they're going through their prosecutors in order to bring those charges up, in other words, it's not coming from an individual or situation taking place lawfully through the sheriff or something like that, but they want to bring a charge against an individual, they need to bring their information to the sheriff, and the sheriff needs to take that to the grand jury to seek an indictment. And there's a lot of details about that process and how that would work, and I'm not going to get into that right at this moment, but it is something that we will probably be discussing in great detail once we get the booklet completed and up on the website. So it's a very important handbook. There's also going to be, there's more information that's going to go into there. There's going to be maybe a jury administrative handbook, period, okay, which gets more specific on the details of their job, their job, what would you call it, not requirements, but, all the processes of what they need to do and how things need to work, how to orientate the jury, whether it's a grand jury or a trial jury, preparing them for the services that they're about to embark on. So there's quite a few booklets that's going to be made. So again, one for the administrative handbook for sheriffs, coroners, and administrators. Another one for an administrative handbook, period, that would be for the jury administrators. And then there is another handbook, which is very specifically written and created for the grand jury themselves. And then there's another handbook, and all these books, with the exception of just the administrative handbook, we didn't start working on that yet, but the one for administrative handbook for sheriff, coroner, and a jury administrator, and the administrators, that's almost complete. The other one, as I mentioned, was the grand jury. That's pretty much complete. We're going to be going through that, perfecting it, hopefully in the next week or so. And some things, again, will probably be added to that, too. Once we're done, we'll post that up. And then we have a petit jury handbook, okay? Because the grand jury has a very different job than the petit jury. So there needs to be two handbooks, one for each one of them. And all of these will be posted up on our website. Not sure where we'll put it yet, probably somewhere under people's duty, but also might be a link also running from under the grand jury. So we'll see where we go with that. Probably under the grand jury, maybe, but we'll think about that. But right now, as far as the sheriff's handbook, that is downloadable right here, right now. The other thing we'll be doing, and again, I know we had some people who were working, were trying to work with us to do some PowerPoints. That kind of fell away from the wayside, and nothing going on with that. We really need somebody who has the ability to do PowerPoints. They need to be able to create the PowerPoint, take the words that we have, particularly in these booklets, okay, and find, get really the important meat out of those books to be put into a presentation, sort of bullet points, and then be able to put the audio to it, read it, and go through it, and turn it into a PowerPoint video. Now, that's something I will eventually do myself if I can't get someone else to do it. We have so many things to do. We need so many more volunteers, and we need people with expertise and or experience in different places. We need people who have experience as paralegals. We need lots of them if possible. We need people who have who's creators, okay, and particularly with PowerPoints, people who are creative with that. And many, many, many other things. But right now, those are the couple of things on my mind of people that we need. So anybody who would like to volunteer their time for that, they can get a hold of Jan. You can find Jan, his name, and phone number and email under the directory. So you can get him here. You can give him a call or drop him an email. and he'll make sure to connect you to the proper people for whatever it is that you're connecting with him for, paralegal work or whatever. And any other thing. You know, we're open. We've got committees going, and there are other committees I'm sure we should be doing and opening. Okay, we did get disconnected. We're back up, and we're going to pick up, really talk a little bit more about becoming an administrator for the jury, which would be both grand and petit juries. By the way, we do have the Q&A session open. Anybody wants to get into the Q&A, *6 and a 1 to get into the Q&A. Generally, I want to finish off. I don't have a particular, I think I covered everything I wanted to cover, but there was one thing I did want to get back to, and that is the pay for that. Obviously right now, this is the time people need to prepare for the work if they want to take these positions. We need 4 people for every county. If you look on our website right now, you will see we have 1,189 people that have signed up for grand jury administrators. We need about 15,000 across the nation. And so in some counties, we'll need more than 4. Bare minimum is 4 because we're working off the Magna Carta, how the Magna Carta laid out the processes of the grand jury, and they talked about 4 individuals that would basically be problem fixers. And if they couldn't fix the problem, they would call the 25. They would call the 25 either for the purpose of considering an indictment, or if it's just an abusive thing, it's not necessarily criminal, and someone's rights is being denied because it may be being denied information from a bureaucrat or whatever the case may be, and they don't yield to the administrators, well, then the administrators can bring that right into the court. To be able to go for that individual to come into the court and go after particularly the bureaucrats who are not obeying. And we'll work that out. All that information will be in the handbook. But anyway, we do need 4 people in every single county. And some counties will require more because they're larger. You know, they got a lot more people. For instance, New York City is broken up into 5 boroughs. A borough down in New York, each borough is a county. It's the county of Bronx, county of Queens, and so on. Manhattan, well, actually, Manhattan is New York, county of New York, New York County. Each one of those have close to a million people each. Some of them may have more, but I know Long Island has 2 counties, and they got quite a few people out there, but that's not really part of New York City. But the point is that they're highly populated, and 4 administrators is not going to be enough for their job. So they're going to have to figure out how many people in order to cover the workload would be required. Could be 6, could be 8, could be 10, I don't know. But generally speaking, it's 4 per county. If an individual, let's put it this way, if someone signs up to be a jury administrator, and whoever finishes the courses first should have the first dibs on the positions to be held so that they would fill that position. So anybody who wants to be administrator should be pushing to our courses. We will put together a course for the administrators themselves, a very special course, which will work off of the handbooks that we're writing, which is the administrative handbook for the sheriff, coroner, and the administrator. The administrative handbook, that's 2nd, and the jury handbook, petit jury handbook, and the grand jury handbook, and the sheriff's handbook. So all those handbooks together, we are going to create a course for the administrators. We may do something special for sheriffs and deputies. We'll think about that. I got some ideas on that. Maybe other people have some ideas, and we'll brainstorm something for that. But maybe we'll create a special course for them, too, that they could take, they can get a certificate on, and it would be helpful for them to work through the processes that they're going to be working through, as far as especially working with the grand jury. Being able to call the grand jury, they come to the administrators and tell them they want to pull a grand jury, the administrators, it would be their job to pull that grand jury. Each county would have a secretary, a legal secretary, working with them for the process, for a lot of the process, really, of pulling the people together and doing various things, which again will all be described in these handbooks. Going back, goodness, I lost my train of thought where this started. Where do we start with on this one?
Well, they were applying for
the bridge. Oh, the administrator, yes. Okay. So, yes, there will be a paid position, but those paid positions can't be paid, obviously, until we get into the courts and start working. And that's when you get paid, of course. You know, right now, remember, the fox is in charge of the hen house. The judge, their clerks, and the prosecutor, and the prosecutor's office, all, they together all do the things that we, the people, need to be doing as far as administrating to the juries. We need to protect the people from coming in to be jurists, to make sure that they're free and independent and untainted. Because right now, every single jury in America, I can't say every single jury in America. I feel confident that I actually could, but there's something one here or there. But generally speaking, they're all tainted. None of them are free, and none of them are independent, because they're controlled by the United States Supreme Court's rules, particularly Rule 2, which goes all the way down into the state and the counties and the towns. The whole thing, the whole process is civil law, because they decided, they knew, these bar attorneys particularly, they know more than the people do, and the people can't take care of their business. They're not smart enough, and they're not, they can't be trusted, so we got to do it. That's their attitude, believe it or not. And pretty much all of them are crooks, in my opinion. I'm sure there's some good people here or there, but they're hard to find. I'll tell you, I haven't found them in my walk yet anyway. So, all right, well, anyway, that's that for that. At some point in time, people working with National Liberty Alliance will be paid also, because our workload will become full-time for lots of people. So the leadership positions of NLA will eventually become paid positions. And I would think they'd be as well paid as the administrators, who, again, is a professional services that they'll be given. And I don't want to get too deep into that, how far down the structure we got, but NLA will have to hire quite a few people to keep things going. There's a lot of work to do, and again, it's a long conversation on what our plans are with NLA once we get to the other side, and one day we'll look into that, and we'll probably have that plan written out in detail. Again, something we need to work with. And again, we need as much help as we can. Also, we need people who could do research, okay? People who are good at researching things and gathering information, paralegals, as I mentioned, and other things. Okay, Gerard sent me a message. He can't get in. Jan, can you try to get a hold of him and see if you can help him, or is there anyone you can send to Gerard to try to help him out?
What I will do is masquerade as him and find out what the hang-up is and get back to him.
Okay, well, that was the last question anyway, right?
I did find one more.
Oh, okay, let's do that one more, and you can go try to help him. Give me that one more question.
This one is, I am one of the plaintiffs in the suit against Freehold Courts, naming the judge and prosecutor as defendants. They ignored my suit for 30 days, which is an admission of guilt. Can we prepare a true bill of indictment and send it to the federal marshal to have them arrested?
Well, I don't know what case he's talking about. Is it a case that he joined with us?
Say again, John, I didn't catch that.
Was he someone that joined his case with us?
It sounds like it, yes. He's one of the...
Well, if he joined his case with us, then we'll be handling the process as far as we can go. Anybody, let me make this very, very clear. And anybody that has joined a case with us, okay, at that point in time, once it comes into us, we then will pick it up and go through the processes that we just explained a little while ago. And And again, we may get some justice, but most of the time we don't, and it'll end up on the other side of justice, so to speak. When the courts become just again and the people take control, it will all those things will be applied. If you have a case with us, you should not be filing any papers or anything in the court for a couple of reasons. Number one, that would disconnect you as a joinder. Okay, it would confuse everybody, number two. And most importantly, you'd be putting yourself back under their jurisdiction. We're trying to get you out from their jurisdiction by going through an amicus curiae, making that show cause challenge, and moving the process forward to get justice, because justice is clear. In the cases that we pick up, justice is absolutely clear. There's not much to it to figure out where the wrongdoing is and how it could be fixed. But anyway, if they have a case with us, you definitely don't want to do anything. You need to just wait. And again, the process will go forward. We're handling all the paperwork. Once we get to the point after the amicus curiae, we handle everything after that. Okay, I guess that's the last question. Gerard, if you can talk or whatever, you can try, see what happens. And right now, I see your mic is open, but I don't hear nothing, so there's no interference. If you want to try to talk.
Does that symbol mean he's not hooked in by audio?
Yeah, you know what? I think it may. Why don't you see if you can get Tech on the line and have him come into the room. Okay? I don't know if you or Terry would want to make that call. But yeah, I guess that means it's weird. I never seen that before.
Okay,
I don't know what that symbol means.
I guess Brent is here, John, if you want to work that.
Okay. All right. Well, while Gerard's working on that problem, hopefully you'll be able to help him, or Terry will be able to help him. We'll move over to Brent. Brent, are you ready? Does Brent come in as an administrator or no?
No,
I don't see him in as an administrator. I don't see Brent.
Let me go to the tail end here.
If he just came in, you should be able to click the duration, the time, and
right.
Work backwards. Right, he is here. Okay. And he's unmuted already. Brent, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. You ready to take the mic?
Well, I'd reckon.
Okay.
But I hear an echo of myself, and I don't know what it is, but I guess, well, now I think it just went away.
Yeah, let me lower my volume because it could be me coming in over my speakers. So,
okay.
Hopefully, if you have any problems, let us know. We'll find out who's modulating over you. Okay, let me introduce you. We're going to move things over to Brent. Brent Allen Winters is an author, a common lawyer. He wrote the book The Excellence of the Common Law. And other books. And matter of fact, he wrote the militia book that we have on a link to off of our website, and also our course, our militia course, okay, was written using that book. But anyway, Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com is his website. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you, John. And my comments are my own, as always, may or may not be in agreement with the leadership of National Liberty Alliance, but as always, they're kind enough to let me come on and say a few words. I want to talk a little bit about the grand jury. The grand jury, I went through law school and I graduated and didn't hear one peep from anybody about the grand jury. Of course, my plate was so full anyway, I didn't say that I missed it. Whatever they told me to do, I just wanted to get done what I was supposed to do and get out of there. And I tried to learn as much as I could, but didn't learn anything about the jury at all, much less the grand jury. And in time later on, I was called to testify before a grand jury regarding my clients, and I didn't do that. That caused a mess, because if you say no to the grand jury, you don't want to testify, the U.S. attorney can get pretty upset. Of course, I wasn't supposed to testify. If you have clients, you're not supposed to testify against them. You're not supposed to reveal confidences. Well, things got worse, and I said, well, I better find out about the grand jury. And then I had clients that were called to testify before the grand jury. And then I found out, of course, I couldn't go in the grand jury room with them. They wouldn't let me. Legal counsel is not allowed in grand jury room. So I could sit outside of the grand jury room while my client went inside. And if I wanted him to, or I was advising him, I couldn't tell him what to do. When it comes to the Fifth Amendment, a lawyer can't force anybody to do anything, much less control them. The Fifth Amendment's under the exclusive control. It's a right. That means that it's a duty of decision whether or not you're going to talk, you decide to talk, or decide not to talk. If you decide to talk, you exercise your duty under the First Amendment protection. If that's the freedom of speech. If you decide not to talk, well, you're exercising your duty under the protection of the Fifth Amendment, the right to not talk. Well, you say, well, how's anybody going to make you talk in the first place? Well, they torture people. That's what they do. They threaten them. They jail their family, their wives, their cousins, their buddies. Say, well, or they'll say something like, well, so-and-so already told us everything anyway, so you may as well go ahead and talk. Well, that's probably a lie. Remember, the government can lie to you all they want, and they won't get in trouble for it. But if you ever lie to a government employee, it's a felony. Keep that in mind. That's why it's best not to talk. Because even when you tell them the truth, you may be accused of telling them the truth to mislead them, which is the same thing as a lie. If they can convince a jury of it, oh yeah, that's happened. I've watched it happen. That's why I advise people don't talk. They aren't kidding when they say anything you say may be used against you. No, they're lying to you. Not may be used against you. It will. That's the way you need to look at it. Well, I just told the truth. Well, they'll twist the truth against you. The problem with government is this, and that it's amazing. It's amazing to me. It's flabbergasting. That doesn't seem like people ever come to grips with the evil of mankind. If you can't come to grips with your own evil, bad chance you'd be coming to grips with the evil of other people, like those that run government. Oh, man. You give power to a fella, maybe you don't have power. If you don't have power, well, that evil that's in you doesn't get that excited. Oh, it's in there. It's a taint. It's an imperfection that's inside of you. But once that is exacerbated by power, a whole lot of weird things can happen. And that's what sometimes does happen. I think I'm losing power. I said power. All of a sudden my computer went dead, it looked like. Like, give me power. Okay, I'm giving you some power here, bro. Gets you turned on there. Yeah, now we got power. Well.
Yeah, we're doing good. We didn't lose anything, but go right ahead.
Oh, good. Let's talk more about the grand jury. Historically, the grand jury has been regarded, I'm quoting from a case, U.S. Supreme Court case from 1962. Historically, this body has been regarded as the primary security to the innocent against hasty, malicious, and oppressive persecution. It serves the invaluable function in our society of standing between the accuser and the accused, whether the latter be an individual, a minority group, or other, to determine whether a charge is founded upon reason or was dictated by an intimidating power or by malice and personal ill will. Often prosecutions are dictated by malice and personal ill will. Now, the reason that the grand jury is is not spoken of, and you don't know anything about it much, and lawyers don't know anything about it much, and if a lawyer hasn't had reason to practice in face of the grand jury and help clients with it, he won't know anything about it. But why is that? Well, because the powers that be don't want anybody to know anything about the grand jury. They want to control it entirely, and right now, the way things stand, prosecutors, at least in the federal courts, control the grand jury entirely, like a puppet. The prosecutor is in charge of the grand jury. The grand jury looks at the United States attorney as though he is their lawyer, and they trust him, and they will do what he says, in most all cases. Now, there is some exception. I know that there have been grand juries, and I've seen this happen, where they've had to convene the grand jury and different grand juries two or three times to get an indictment. But they'll get the indictment, and there's no limit to how many times they convene the grand jury. They'll finally find one that'll bring in an indictment, a true bill, as we say at common law. Is the grand jury a good thing? It's a good thing. It's a good thing. But if you turn it over to a government employee, I don't see what good it is. It just becomes a dangerous thing. I mean, if the grand jury is under control of the United States attorney, if the United States attorney is advisor to the grand jury, and that's what the law says as it stands now, what good is it? Well, we need to get rid of it. Oh, okay, we get rid of it. Now you've taken down another barrier, and you've just put in prosecution and an indictment in the hands of a single employee of the state called the U.S. attorney. Do you want that? No, I don't want that. Well, then leave the grand jury in place at least. The grand jury makes them work at it a little bit. I'll say that much. Well, there was a fellow up in Montana back in the late 70s and early 80s. He died last year. He's called the father of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Fully informed jury, that means you're supposed to tell the jury when they're impaneled. That's the group of guys that says we got to make sure the jury knows when they're impaneled that they have the power to judge not only the facts, but be judges of the law and rule the law void and null if they want to. Does the jury have that power as a matter of law? Oh, yeah, they got that authority to do that. And as a matter of law, they can't be punished for it. But the government, the powers that be, and judges and lawyers, and by and large lawyers, oh yeah, prosecutors, they don't want grand juries to know that. They want the grand jury to be dependent upon that lone employee of the state called the prosecutor. So they don't tell them. Well, this fellow up in Montana, his name was Martin Beckman. Martin Beckman. His nickname was Red. Everybody called him Red. Well, the IRS came and said that he was going to take his house. And he fought him, lost. But he wouldn't get out of the house. And they ordered him out. He still wouldn't get out. So they hired a bulldozer, a D6 or a D8, to come in. They bulldozed down his house. It was out in the middle of nowhere. It didn't bother anybody else. That's the story I got. Well, he said, what am I going to do? So he raised a lot of money, and he got on television in Montana back in the days of television. And he put together a presentation about the power that a grand juror has. And he put it on television all over Montana. Well, the federal government had a hard time getting an indictment, or the U.S. attorneys up there, for about 4 or 5 years, and that really upset them. Told people it was an education program, telling people the power of the grand jury. He had it figured out. He said, this is where the bottleneck is. If we can close this bottleneck, all this false prosecution, false persecution, and false indictments, maybe it would stop. Well, it did for a while. But, of course, when he quit doing that, he went to Pat Robertson after that. Pat Robertson had this big Christian TV network all over the country, still does, as far as I No, the name of it was Trinity Broadcasting Network, I believe, TBN or something like that. So he went to him and said, look, I got plenty of money. I've raised the money. I worked in Montana. I want to buy time on your broadcasting network, and play this seminar. He had a little seminar he did, had a chalkboard where he'd show people things and draw diagrams, and he was a very effective communicator. He wasn't a formally educated man. I think he graduated from high school. He had some formal education, but he's just a smart guy, and he made a good presentation about the grand jury. Eventually, organization called the Fully Informed Jury Association was formed. I believe it's still out there, and you can go to their website and talk to them, find out what they're doing. But the dopers took over that organization, the folk that wanted to legalize rope so they could smoke it. They took it over. Well, their idea about the Fully Informed Jury Association was right, but all these potheads running the organization kind of changed the color of it. Martin Beckman was very much a Christian man, and he didn't take that point of view about pot, but the potheads took over. And not to say that they didn't have something to say. Pot should not be an illegal drug. I think the Bible's clear on things like that, because it doesn't make such things a crime. Liquor, drugs, opiates, does say they're dangerous and says stay away from them and don't be stupid, but it doesn't raise them to the level of criminal liability. And so if we go outside of what the Bible says is criminal liability, we will be made fools of in time, and that's what's happening, of course, now. But at any rate, the potheads took over, and he didn't have much more to do with it after that. The principal was there. Well, the grand jury is important. And no country in the history of mankind that has kept its jury and its grand jury has ever lost its freedom. Of course, that's not saying much. There's only about five major countries in the world that even have juries. And the grand jury is utterly rare among those countries. It's done away with in England, common law country, I believe 1935, they did away with the grand jury. Had it for centuries. Of course, it came with English-speaking people to the New World. And then we decided we'd put it in our Constitution of the United States, Article or Amendment 6, so that it would be protected. And so it's here on the federal level. Now, a lot of the states have done away with it. A lot of them haven't. But across the board, it's unclear as a matter of law, really, really unclear as to how it is to operate and what the rules are and who impanels it, and especially at the state levels. And that's what is important now that we should give attention to. The grand jury is an ancient institution. It emerged centuries ago in England, ostensibly to serve as a shield between the state and the individual, protecting the latter from unfounded criminal charges. England abolished the grand jury. I said 1935, I was wrong. It was 1933. But it flourishes in the United States, especially, as I'd said, at the federal level. The way it is utilized, however, has led some to question whether the modern American grand jury performs its historic function of acting as a buffer between the powers that be, and the people themselves. In the last few decades, the grand jury has become a federal prosecutor's preferred means of investigating certain types of cases, especially those involving complex criminal activity such as white-collar crime and political corruption. Prosecutors at the federal level favor grand juries because of the power they exercise. A grand jury investigating a criminal activity operates unconstrained by the Miranda rules. The Miranda rules do not constrain grand juries at the federal level. I'm speaking at the federal level. Neither do the common law rules of evidence restrain grand juries. They can look at anything they want. They can look at it without any argument. Their subpoenas must be obeyed. They can subpoena witnesses from, grand jurors can, from anywhere in the United States, which effectually means that the U.S. attorney can subpoena witnesses, because the U.S. attorney will tell the grand jury what he wants, and in most all cases, the grand jury will just say, well, whatever you tell us, that's what we need to do. Why? Because grand jurors know about as much about the functioning and the purposes of a grand jury as do lawyers in the United States. Now, can you fault lawyers for that? No, but you can fault lawyers that are U.S. attorneys for that and lawyers that are prosecutors for that. Oh, yeah. It's their fault. They don't want anybody to know. It is a mystery, the grand jury. It has developed to the point that it's, well, it's just a rubber stamp. It is a buffer, though, a little bit. It is one more step they have to go through. And if we ever get the thing to where it functions as it is supposed to do, it'll do a lot of good. But getting rid of it is not the answer. Because getting rid of it, once you get rid of it, you'll never get it back. They've proven that in England. Remember, 1933, they got rid of it by an act of Parliament. And they haven't had it back. And we're now pushing forward to 100 years, and they haven't had the grand jury in England. But prosecutors are attracted to certain features of grand jury. Unlike a trial or petit jury, a grand jury's activities are clandestine. They're shrouded in secrecy. Well, that's ancient. What goes on inside the grand jury room has always been secret. No one knows what they're investigating. That's okay. But a grand jury is not controlled by a judge. The grand jury, according to the Williams case, 1992, U.S. Supreme Court decision, Justice Scalia, the grand jury is technically independent of any of the branches of government, though grand juries usually rely on prosecutors to direct their activities, as I had said before, unlike the trial for which a petit jury is impaneled. A grand jury proceeding is an ex parte affair. Ex parte, ex, that means out of. Parte means apart. Why don't they just say it's a one-sided affair? That's what it is in just common American English. It's a one-sided affair. Those under investigation have no right to attend the grand jury sessions or to present evidence before it. Well, how can that be, you say? Well, not until a fellow is indicted does he have standing before the court in the case. As long as a grand jury is investigating something, the people they're investigating haven't been indicted yet, so they're not a party in any case. See, a grand jury is an investigating body. That's what it is. It investigates evidence in the community, and it says yes or it says no. Yes, Mr. Prosecutor, you may try this person for a crime. Yes, we believe it is more likely than not he committed the crime. It is probable, that's what probability amounts to, more likely than not. It is probable he committed a crime. Therefore, we give you permission to try him before the petit jury. Remember, the duty of a juror, whether grand juror or petit juror, is to say yes to the government or to say no. They have to say one or the other. Yes, you may try this man. No, you may not. Now, the petit jury is, yes, you may take this man's life, liberty, or property for the crime that you accused him of, or no, you may not. Yes or no. Has to be one or the other. That's the duty of a juror, to say yes or to say no. That's all the jury has to do. And in both cases of the grand jury and of the petit jury, in both of those cases, it takes 12 to say yes or 12 to say no. With the grand jury, it takes 12 to say yes. Yes, you may try this person. It doesn't make any difference whether there are 12 people, 12 men on the grand jury, 15 men, 16 men, 23 men, 25 men, or 48 men. It takes 12 to indict. Now, traditionally, in America, the grand jury has been from 16 to 23 persons. 16 to 23. That's been the tradition. Doesn't mean it has to be that way. Trial jury, of course, is 12. Well, surprisingly, given the power the grand jury wields, the grand jury is an often overlooked and little understood phenomenon in American law. Not little, that's an understatement. Nobody knows diddly squat in America about the grand jury unless you've been drug in front of one or served on one or been a U.S. attorney. Then you know a little. Other than that, you don't know. Only those who frequently deal with grand juries, such as federal prosecutors and defense attorneys specializing in federal criminal law, grasp the practical significance of a grand jury investigation or appreciate the intricacies of a grand jury practice. And even they may not have encountered some of its more obscure aspects. That's true. That's true. Well, that's an introduction to the grand jury. I hope to talk more about it next week. So stay tuned. Stay tuned at this station next week. Maybe we'll talk more about it again.
Okay, very good, Brent. Thank you. And it's interesting because before you came in, we were talking a little bit about that, and you said a lot of things that I had to say, and so that's good to be consistent with those conclusions. Gerard, are you back yet with your mic? Can you get your mic going? See if you can unmute yourself and speak.
I think I finally got the stupid thing figured out.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, give me a couple of minutes and I'll pass things over to you, okay?
Okay, yep.
All right, Brent, you're not in as an administrator, so we're going to try to keep you unmuted. When we go to click for the next person to take the mic, you might drop. It'll probably mute you, so we'll try to find you to unmute you.
Okay.
But if that doesn't work well, you can always call back in as an administrator. But if you have any comments or thoughts as we go along, feel free to pipe in. Right?
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Okay, yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the grand jury before I pass things over to Gerard. We're working on a book, like I said, the handbook, which is the Grand Jury Administrative Handbook. And we do talk about addressing the grand jury. But just to go up real quick, again, this book is Jury Administrator's Handbook. Probably should be maybe put an apostrophe S here, I think. I don't know. Let's see. Administrator's Handbook for Sheriff, Coroners, and Administrators. Anyway, I'd like to just read a couple of paragraphs here. Very interesting. Again, I just had my epiphany on this recently. I wasn't aware of this, and it became obvious in a conversation we had, I had with Brent, Gerard, and others. But anyway, addressing the grand jury. Prosecutors are not empowered by the common law. They are empowered by statutes. Let that sink in. That is extremely important to realize that. Okay? They're not empowered by the common law. So any power that they're given as a prosecutor, okay, we do need prosecutors in court as part of the process, but any powers that they may be given cannot go beyond the Constitution of that state. It cannot go beyond the rules of common law. And nobody can, no government official without the authority to empower another government official with power other than that which has already been vested into that person. So in the United States Constitution, for instance, we vested judges. We vested the Supreme Court. But we also vested Congress to create, let me see how that was worded. It's not courts, but they were able to vest others, you know, which would be limited, not superior, but inferior courts. I think that was the wording of the Constitution, that they can create an inferior court to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. So we give certain powers for our, you know, whether it's an elected individual, an appointed individual, an individual who's just employed by government. You know, we vested these people with certain powers and authorities, and we vested, you know, Congress to mete out other things in the Constitution, particularly under Article 1, Section 8, where we've given them 18 powers, and one of them is powers to write law concerning the 17 powers mentioned in that particular article. So the key thing here is prosecutors are not empowered by the common law. They are empowered by statutes, whereas sheriffs, coroners, and the jury administrators, which are people, and we got this particular authority and power from Magna Carta. So anyway, the jury administrators are empowered by the common law. Their sole purpose is to serve true justice via the rules of common law. The common law grand jury is the people and are not to be controlled by the government. And only the people, sheriff and coroners, can summons and present before the common law grand jury. The American Bar Association controlled legislators and courts, stole our courts of record by codifying procedures to call the grand jury, and over time expelled the people, the sheriff, the coroners, from participating, thereby hijacking the grand jury, carrying them away to jurisdictions unknown under civil law, to jurisdictions unknown, as they covertly concealed the common law courts via the 1934 Rules Enabling Act that claims to have abrogated the common law via Rule 2. A famous modern legal term that a prosecutor, jesting inappropriately, can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich was immortalized in the Tom Wolfe novel Bonfire of the Vanities in 1987. But it was Sal Wachtler, chief judge of the New York State Court of Appeals, who in 1985 said, "District attorneys now have so much influence on grand juries that by and large they could get them to indict a ham sandwich." This is an insult and a caricature to both justice and the American people, displaying proof positive the unlawful influence government prosecutors have over our grand juries. As noted earlier in this particular paper, and deserving reiteration, the authority to judge what are the powers of the government and what are the liberties of the people must necessarily be vested in one or the other of the parties themselves, the government or the people, because there is no third party to whom it can be entrusted. If the authority be vested in the government is absolute, and the people have no liberties except such as the government sees fit to indulge them with. If the government can select the juries, it will, of course, select those whom it supposes will be favorable to its enactments, like they do now, and an exclusion of any of the free men from eligibility is a selection of those not excluded, like they do now. It will be seen from the statute cited that the most absolute authority over the jury box, that is, over the right of the people to sit in juries, has been usurped by the government. Now that, all this quote I got out of Trial by Jury, Lysander Spooner, which we do have a copy, and everybody should go up and listen. We have it both in audio and we have it written. In a minute, I'll show you where it's at, maybe. I should be able to find it pretty quickly. But you can go up and you can download the audios and you can listen to the Lysander Spooner's Trial on Jury, and you can also read along with it. "We, the sovereign people, never gave the legislators, judges, or prosecutors any authority to call or address the common law grand jury directly." Now remember, the grand jury is an unalienable right of the people. Trial jury is an unalienable right of the people. This is dealt with in the Bill of Rights and not in the body of the Constitution concerning the grand jury particularly. And so therefore, it is the people's grand jury. It is the people's petit jury. It is the people who make the law and save the law. They have the power of nullification. They have the power to decide at the end what the remedy is. Everything. No judge can do that. We never gave a judge a power to do that, to judge our liberties, to judge our behavior. I mean, we'd be silly, stupid, when you think about it. We'd be stupid to give it up to a judge. But because the people don't understand who they are and their liberties and their powers and their authorities, then through our ignorance, we forfeited it. We need to take it back. Anyway, we, the sovereign people, never gave the legislators, judges, or prosecutors any authority to call or address the common law grand jury directly. If the government wants to ask for an indictment of the people, they need to bring their evidence, including exculpatory evidence, to the sheriff, who will then summons the grand jury through the jury administrators, and then address the grand jury. If the people want to bring criminal charges before the grand jury, they should address their case by sworn affidavits to the sheriff, who will bring it to the grand jury. Well, probably, maybe we'll change that, and we will direct the people to go to the sheriff and make the sworn complaints and then let the sheriff deal with it. The people in the four administrators would really deal with more or less situations where bureaucrats are ignoring their rights, refusing to give information, and things like that, which we can assist them with. But anyway, we'll work that out later. In the dealing with the grand jury, the sheriff or the coroner have a duty to address the grand jury. They are not obligated to provide the jury with exculpatory evidence, but at the same time, they are obligated to ensure that innocence does not suffer. If the exculpatory evidence clearly negates the guilt of the accused, the case, therefore, simply should not be brought before the grand jury. In any event, exculpatory evidence must be acknowledged and shared with the defendant and the defendant's counsel. The problem with sharing exculpatory evidence with the grand jury is that it changes the purpose of the grand jury to a petit jury. I think Brent made that point pretty clear when he was speaking. The sheriff must recognize that the grand jury is an independent body whose functionings include not only the investigation of a crime and the initiation of a criminal prosecution, but also the protection of the citizenry from unfounded criminal charges. The sheriff's responsibility is to present the evidence for its consideration. In discharging these responsibilities, the sheriff must be scrupulously fair to all witnesses and must do nothing to inflame or otherwise improperly influence the grand jurors. If the people are being abused or their rights are being ignored by a bureaucrat, they can bring their concerns to the attention of the four jury administrators, who shall cause, and this we're getting right from, again, the Magna Carta. If the people are being abused or their rights are being ignored by a bureaucrat, they can bring their concerns to the attention of the four jury administrators, who shall cause that error to be amended without delay. If our justice does not amend it within a term of 40 days, from the time when it was shown to us, the matter shall be brought before a petit jury in a show cause for judgment. The constitutions of most of our states assert that all power is inherent in the people, that they may exercise it by themselves in all cases to which they think themselves competent, as in electing their functionaries, executives, and legislators, and deciding by a jury of themselves both facts and law in all judiciary cases in which any fact is involved. And Thomas Jefferson wrote that. Okay, that's about all I'm going to say about that tonight, and Brent hopefully will come and share some more. Go ahead, Gerard. Well, let me pass things over to you first, okay?
Okay.
And then you can pick up on that. So you got control of the board and everything, so I'll kind of mute myself and sit in and listen and participate as necessary. You got it.
Listen, I want to add something to what you just said. I learned after talking to Brent and you, and then I went back into U.S. versus Williams, and I'm going to tell you, U.S. versus Williams, I rely heavily on myself, but I always made the mistake of not reading the first part because they did such a nice job highlighting the high points. And so there's some highlighting in the beginning, in the first chapter.
By the way, I did the highlighting, but go ahead.
Well, I like it, but I always skip the first highlighting and go down to the rest of it because it kind of repeats itself. But there's a very important paragraph in here that we keep missing that really, I didn't realize how much Scalia did to turn the grand jury around. The other night when we went in and we read what they did in 1965 to gut the grand jury by saying the grand jury decision, if they want to indict, has to be signed by the prosecutor, basically, you know, sterilize them, so to speak, because they have to have the prosecutor signature or the indictment that they just worked on would not fly. So that put all the control in the prosecutor's hand, which is bad. We know it's bad. We just discussed it here for 20 minutes. But if you go up here, it says, and this is important because, and I think if I would have read it more, it would have come to me quicker. An imposition of the Court of Appeals disclosure rule not supported by the court's inherent supervisory power, quote unquote, to formulate procedural rules not specifically required by the Constitution or the Congress. This court's cases relying upon that power deal strictly with the court's control over their own procedures, whereas the grand jury is an institution separate from the courts over whose functioning the courts do not preside. Now, further on, any power federal courts may have to fashion their own initiative rules of grand jury procedure is very limited and certainly would not permit the reshaping of the grand jury institution that would be the consequent of the proposed rule here. And it gives you page 45 to 50. So there was a proposed rule, again, rules, this is what we always warn against here, they're stupid rules, right? The Court of Appeals rule would neither preserve nor enhance the traditional functioning of the grand jury that the common law of the Fifth Amendment demands. So right there, for them to say common law has been abrogated, you see what Scalia did? He firmly stuck it back in there, didn't he? It's impossible to abrogate it because the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence are common law documents, and they even said if you don't have common law, you can't understand it. It has to be in the light of that. So he did a lot better job than I thought he did right there in the beginning, and I always jumped over that and didn't really let that sink in a little bit, that what he just said there. You know, the Court of Appeals rule would neither preserve nor enhance the traditional functioning of the grand jury that the common law of the Fifth Amendment demands. Very powerful sentence that, I, you know, really makes more sense now that we've been discussing this. The other thing I wanted to talk about, John, was, you know, in the beginning I heard you, I couldn't talk because I was muted, and you said people choke on the fact that you are the law, that you make the law. And you said, of course, it has to adhere to the Constitution. That's the caveat that's misunderstood today. They don't understand that that's the measuring stick, because this is why you're getting all kinds of Sharia law. Look, you can't go in and put, you are the law. Well, guess what? If you want to put Sharia law in, guess that's not our law. Our law comes from the God of nature and nature's God, which is a different God than the Sharia law's God, than the Muslim God. I'm sorry, and if that's... anybody wants to disagree with that, it's the truth. The other thing is...
Yeah, that foundation, by the way, is clearly stated in the Declaration of Independence.
And they want to forget about it. And they call it, you know, it's freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. They've twisted everything on its head. Black is white, white is black. Everything's upside down today. And the other problem is we should never, ever let any communist Marxist parties run or control anything, because their very existence is the overthrow of our Constitution. They don't even fit together. It's subversive. Its whole design is to tear. How could you say, well, they have a constitutional right to put their... So it's like saying they have a constitutional right to do terrorism on our Constitution, because that's what you're saying. It always was against the law in the United States to be a communist. Now they're running communist parties and workers' parties and all this fist stuff and hammer and all this. You can't have it, because what it does is it undermines the morals and it undermines the basic tenets of what our whole country was formed in. And anybody that, you know, they put that in because people don't understand the Constitution. And obviously, Scalia saw the need, you know, in 63 was when the other guy was saying, oh, no, the prosecutor has to sign the thing, right? So in 91, Scalia came back in this case and kind of turned that right on its head now, didn't he? So anyway, I just thought it was important to clear that up. And you can go to that case on U.S. versus William under the grand jury tab and look for landmark Supreme Court cases, and it's in there, the Williams. And I read it all the time, but look, I just pull something else out of it. How many years have we been reading this, John, and quoting it? But I don't know why I always skipped over the beginning. It looked the same to me, but there's a couple points in there that really nail that. They were making a rule, you know, just like these courts do. They want this rule and that rule. And, you know, a lot of times we go into court, they say, well, yeah, that's rule something. And John goes, we don't go by that. That's not us. We're the common law grand jury. And that's exactly what he means by that. We don't follow rules that are immanical to the Constitution. You know, I don't even know why we need to explain that, but I guess we do, you know, because people have strayed that far from it. So I don't want to get lost, but I just figured that was a good, shoring up of that position. Let me find my screen here so I can...
Well, indeed, we did stray very, very far away from our heritage, from the truth. And look, this is by design. You know, Jefferson spoke about a proper education, and it is the government's responsibility and duty to make sure that happens within our education. But they have not, because, you know, in order to turn us into slaves, and scrabble our mind up so badly that we don't even know anymore what is logical, what is just, what is right, so to speak. People scratch their heads and I'm not sure. But we have to become sure. We have to be able to see self-evident truths. Self-evident truths rule the court. And they're plain to see for anybody who has common sense and the right heart. In other words, looking at it from the right heart. You know, because God put His laws into our hearts. He wrote it into our hearts. We know when a wrongdoing was done, and we know if we know who did it, we can see clearly once it's laid out in a court case an injury was received and given by someone and received by another. But anyway. You know, all of these papers that we're talking about are on our website. We have a tremendous amount of information here. Here's our founding documents. This education tab, you know, people should be browsing through here and looking through and reading through. But here's the essays and lectures I was talking about. You can go here to Trial by Jury. And if you click on Trial by Jury, and we're doing this on our browser, anybody who can watch their browser, we have... Trial by Jury, we have it in audio. It's 21 audios. I'm not sure how long each one of those audios are. Let me just click this real quick to see. This is a short one.
It's like 20 minutes to a half hour.
Huh?
They're not very long.
Yeah, they're short. We do have the entire Trial by Jury in a PDF form. You click on that. Okay. You can open up the Trial by Jury. You can read through it. And listen, actually, as you're reading through it, or just read it if you want. It's 187 pages. It's a course in its own, so you could be listening here on the Trial by Jury as you read through it. And of course, you can rewind and re-listen to anything you want and get it. But look, if we the people don't start digging deep to find out what our heritage is, what the truth is about our nation, and what the truth is about Thomas Jefferson... You know, Thomas Jefferson has been maligned so bad and horribly, and they have to destroy Thomas Jefferson because he is the voice of our heritage. He has done so much to really bring the knowledge out and an understanding of common law. You know, he is the one that found America ultimately, okay? And it starts with the Declaration of Independence. And Thomas Jefferson, we did a study on him. And there is a great book out there called The Real Thomas Jefferson. You can get a copy of this book at NCCS, I think it's .net, NCCS.net, which stands for National Center for Constitutional Studies. And if you buy a bunch of these books, you can get the Benjamin Franklin, The Real Benjamin Franklin, The Real George Washington, you get The Making of America, you can get Thomas Jefferson, The Real Thomas Jefferson. And they have these books, you can buy like five or six of them. And if you buy them in a package, they're like $5 or $6 a piece. So, I mean, for $30, you can get six great books that will give you so much knowledge and understanding of who we are as a people. Okay? And in these books, this is where I discovered this Real Thomas Jefferson book. which is all documentation from his, in his day, it's from his letters and communications with others and others communicating back with him, documents, things, other things that he wrote and other people wrote about him, and interviews that took place concerning the integrity of Jefferson and so on. But when Jefferson...
That's how you can tell they're lying about him. Because they show you a letter he wrote and back and forth in their own handwriting. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But there's so many lies, and that's right there is the way you can check, right there.
When Jefferson was in his 20s, he was asked to participate in being a legislator, and he was sent, you know, the state sent him as a legislator, or a state legislator, and he was in his 20s. I think he was 28, 29. He was very young. And his father had died, passed away. I believe he was 15 or 14, somewhere between 14 and 6. I think he was 14. And so he lost his father, but he had really a lot of great people around him, and he had one individual that schooled him. So he got a really great education. But in any event, when his father died, he inherited all the slaves. Jefferson never purchased or sold a slave in his entire life. Now, in his research, he had a great love for the slaves that were his slaves, and you can read about it. He talks about this, but in any event, when he was in his early 20s. 20s, he was about 28 years old, he was sent as a legislator, and his first order of business was to change the law in Virginia so that slaves can be emancipated. And his idea was to emancipate his slaves, because he refused to sell them, to emancipate his slaves and then teach them, because it was illegal to teach a slave to read or do anything. You know, you had to keep them ignorant. So it was against the law for him to do those things. So he tried that his first time as a legislator. Some years later, he went, I think, two or three times as a legislator. In all cases, he first order business was trying to change the law because he wanted to emancipate his slaves. And so if he wanted to get rid of his slaves, he had only one option, and that was to sell them, and he refused to do it. And they don't tell you about this. But it goes on, and what does he do? He writes the Declaration of Independence, and he makes it clear that all men are created equal. And he also worked diligently with other founding fathers, and I'm still researching some of this out, but there are other founding fathers that really were dead against slavery and were trying to change it there in Virginia particularly. Washington was among them. So, you know, all these lies we hear about Jefferson, and it's also that we don't talk about Jefferson. It's like you're afraid to mention his name. I heard on BCP a couple of days ago, right before the weekend, I think it was, in a conversation that was taking place. In fact, what's BCP's first name? Do you remember? I'm not even sure he's ever said.
Yeah, I don't know if he's ever said either. But
But anyway, BCP mentioned Jefferson's name, but then... I forget exactly the words he said, but he spoke in such a way that, you know, it was a problem. He was a conflict in himself, and, you know, he was contradicting himself, and something very simple, but he went on to talk. But he wanted to bring something up about Jefferson that was beneficial to whatever he was talking about, but he had to almost apologize for the fact that he was a slave owner and all this other stuff. But nothing could be further from the truth. He never purchased a slave in his life. He never sold them. And he said, if I were to just free the slaves, okay, it would be, he said it would be like taking your child and dropping them off and abandoning them in the marketplace. He says that's how he looked at it. He said his idea, again, was to emancipate them and to educate them. But never could happen, at least not in his lifetime. But it did happen later.
I think you need to apologize for that, John. I think you need to apologize for the terrible things that were done to them.
Yes, I think so too.
It's your white privilege that did that. You know, I think this is turning out to be a good thing. because people, I see more people of color getting on, making YouTube videos. One guy, one black guy was crying by the end of it, and he said, "You don't bow down to them." And at the end he says, "And I want to apologize for all my black people that have done this to you. You have no guilt at all." I mean, really, really emotional stuff. And it's coming out. And it's coming out because they've brought it to a head. And really, this whole racism thing was just about dead. It's very, you know, they asked one of these black, very famous black rapper guys, and he said, "Well, what about the racism you had to face? You know, this guy's like 28 or something." He said, "You don't want to ask me that question." He says, "I never in my whole life felt that there was any racism at all for me." I mean, this is amazing, you know? I don't know where he lived. I don't know what area of the country he lived in or whatever it was, but, you know, it was a mix of blacks and whites, and he said, "I never experienced anything like that." So this is what, and they're saying that's baloney, that you know, every black experiences that. And I always figured that was true because I've witnessed racism in my life. Certainly in the days that we grew up, there was a lot of rioting and there were a lot of prejudiced people. There's no doubt about it. And that's kind of what Trump brings up as far as the Democratic Party goes. They were the party of the Ku Klux Klan. They were the ones that were discriminating against them and wanted to keep them down. Isn't it so strange that now they're out there, you know, saying that they're going to free them and they're trying to turn the country into a Marxist socialist place to do it? It's sick. But I think there's good things coming, and I think that this was probably something that people had to see, like you know, you can tell people, but until they see it, they don't believe it. So I think this is part of the seeing before the judgment, before they all get judged, all these people that have been doing these horrible things. So anyway, listen, we should get some more people in the queue. We don't have that many because that's coming up next. I think that's all I wanted to say. Were you done, John?
Yeah, I'm done. Star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Anybody got a question or a comment? Star 6 and a 1.
You know what? We should send BCP a book. If it's only $6 on the real Jefferson, he'd probably appreciate that.
You know, that is true. We should. You know, look, at one of the problems with these people on YouTube, it's hard to get a hold of them. I've gone in and tried to get a hold of certain individuals, and you go into, you know, where you can try to communicate with them, and some of them have the regular setup that I guess YouTube gives them, where you put your information there. You really can't say much. But it's hard to find a mailing address for them. It's hard to find an email or a phone number for them. I can understand.
BCP has numerous platforms, and you might not be able to get a hold of him on his YouTube platform, but he has Twitter. He has a website. There's one of them that he's paying attention to because I think he's very accessible.
Well, again, this is where we can use someone that could do some research for us on these kind of things, you know, discovering individuals on YouTube that have a reasonably good amount of people that are following along, delivering the right message where we can assist them. We need to get the education to those people. We need to be able to give them the information we have so that they can get educated and participate in the taking back of this nation. Because, you know, only the people can save America, period. Donald Trump cannot save America. If we do not step up to take control, one day he's going to leave office, okay, and somebody else is going to come in place. And if we, the people, haven't taken control by then, window of opportunity will be lost. We have to do it now. We only have a few years. You know, we have the rest of his term, which I think he's got maybe another 6 months, and I'm convinced he's going to be, reelected. So we have another couple of years, you know, 4 years, but we have to accomplish it in the next couple of years, maximum. And we have to really, I've been thinking of doing an information to President Trump concerning the fact that, look, you got to stop talking about conservatism. Conservatism means something different today than it did yesterday. You know, being a liberal meant something quite different 200 years ago than it does today. You know, all the meanings of those things change by the times and what's going on. No, we have to be constitutionalists. We have to be true Americans. We have to be the consenters of government. And so he needs to start using some words that really come out of the Constitution, that comes out of the Bill of Rights. You know, we're a republic, and what does that mean? You know, common law, natural law, the Declaration. You know, key words and phrases that needs to be brought out. But we definitely should not be using the word conservatives, nor should we talk about ourselves being a democracy. Our founding fathers despised the democracy. We are not a democracy. You know, Jefferson used the phrase a democratic republic, okay? And that was really, I think that was the Anti-Federalists came up with that, and then eventually the Anti-Federalists. But it was called a democratic republic because we are a republic. We're a people of law. We're not a people of democracy. Democracy is two wolves and a lamb debating on what's for dinner. I think this is Franklin, but it could be Jefferson. I'm pretty sure it was Franklin, though. But liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote, okay? We are not a democracy. We are a republic. The only thing is, which is logical, it's self-evident, it's obvious, we need to choose our representatives in a democratic way. But that doesn't make us a democracy. We are a republic. All right, anyway, I'm done.
Okay, I just one real quick thought. In your lawsuit against Google, you put in there, you know, you're going to get so many, $1 billion, whatever it was.
$4 billion.
$4 billion. And I said, you know, that's not a lot of money for them because they have multiple billions between Google and Facebook.
They're almost $1 trillion collectively.
Right. So that's like a pimple. They don't care about it. But the one thing that's going to make them care, John, is you put in there that you were going to use that money for the the kids, and they go to their graves before they give you that money for that. That's the thing that's going to bother them. Maybe you don't want to put that in there.
It'll burn. Well, it's already done. As a matter of fact,
that's,
you know,
more money than George Soros spent, John.
just to let everybody know, I sent this out last Monday, and I got it back on Wednesday. They sent it back to me, and the error was on my side. Actually, I didn't get it back till Thursday. And the error was on my side, so I fixed it, and I got it back out on Friday. Just so you know, they received it today, all of them.
Dun, 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 dun.
And we sent the copy to President Trump and also Attorney General Barr.
You know what?
We need to send out a copy to We the People and, oh, goodness, what's that other guy's name that's out there doing some good work in the courts?
Veritas, what's his name? Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
The one that's doing the FOIA request all over.
Right,
there.
Right. What's that group again? What's it really called?
Jim, is it Jim? Not Jim, no.
No. In any event, we need to send, we were sending him a copy also of everything we were doing, and we were sending Robert Schultz with We the People. I didn't send them a copy of this particular lawsuit, but I think I'll send it out maybe this week to them. Right, Judicial Watch. Thank you, friends. Tom Fitton with Judicial Watch.
Yeah. And I think that, I'll be honest with you, it was almost prophetic that thing should have come back because there were discussions going on up with Trump and Barr and them up there that I think make our suit even more time on time.
Yeah, timing is everything, and we're not controlling that, but it does happen to locals.
They're very much on this business of them censoring and what they're doing, and there was some good dialogue up there about that, like that they were saying, we're going to take care of that and it needs to stop now. There was talk this week, and you just sent it in this week.
I also made a change. One of the changes, only one change, really. And it was something that was bothering me. And after I put it in, it bothered me even more. And I said, I should have done it different. But I didn't. But then it came back, and I said, this is opportunity for me to do it. Maybe that's why I got it back. Right. What I did was I called it a verified paper, you know, action at law, verified, which means it's a sworn affidavit at the end. It's sworn to, and we did lend a seal from the grand jury. Perspective, because it's the grand jury, that is doing the suit on behalf of the people. And so we had a seal, and we had Gerard's signature and my signature, two signatures. As the foreman of the grand jury, and the other one, as a jury administrator. That's what we did. And I said to myself, you know, they're going to throw this out because there's no sworn affidavit, even though they never require that. Often they don't require it. People file things and there's no sworn affidavit. It happens all the time. Look at the IRS to begin with. But so when this came back, I said, let me do this in an affidavit form. So I still put a seal on it, and I did it in an affidavit form and swore to it before a notary and then sent it out on Friday. So I think that was important. Now, I know they're going to really challenge this. I did not. In New York, when we file in the Supreme Court, we call our state court the Supreme Court, and every county has a Supreme Court in it. So it's New York Supreme Court, County of Dutchess, New York Supreme Court, County of Orange, and so on, et cetera, all the way through 62 counties. And so when we file the papers here in New York, you can get the index number, which we're going to ask for our money back when we get in, you know, when they do pull us into the court. We spend $210 to get the index number. And then there's another paper that you would file, which requests for it's what's called an RJI here in New York. I don't know how they do it in other states, but that's a request for judicial intervention, right? Interference, actually.
Yeah.
I really wanted to say.
Truth be known.
Request for judiciary intervention. And so I didn't file for that. Now, we're suing corporations, which are fiction, okay? They really can't ask for much. They need to just answer, really, and defend themselves, of course. But, you know, we didn't ask for that. Now, I always, whenever I file a state court case, I always do it that way. And the other side immediately goes, and they get upset with me because I didn't file that, and they have to go out and pay the $95, I guess, and to get it in. But we're going to deny that RJI because this is a common law court. We're very clear. There's not going to be any summary judgments here. There's not going to be any civil rules, civil law rules involved. We're not under the rules of the court. We're under the rules of common law. Everything is clearly laid out in this paper. So when we do go in, they're going to pull us in. I know they are. Now, this is going to be heard in Dutchess County, which is Poughkeepsie, New York, is where the courthouse is. So anybody that isn't too far from that destination when the day comes, as soon as I know that they do it, I'm going to blast it through our email addresses for the membership, and also we'll talk about it on the Mondays coming up. But we really do need as many people as possible in that court on that day when we make the argument to let that judge know that he has no power or authority. This is not proper. And we the people did not ask for intervention from any judge. No judges involved here. We are looking into a common law court. Now, of course, if you want to just decide for us, we'll accept that. Okay, but of course, he really can't even do that. At least not until the others answer. But they'll try to do that in order so they don't have to answer, because that's their game that they play. They get a hold of the judge. They push for a court date. You have a hearing. And the judge will throw us out under, what is that, Rule 12? It's been a long time since I spoke about that one. But they'll throw us out for failing to state a cause or something like that, to get the words. So anyway, we're going to need as many people as possible to come to that hearing. We want to intimidate that judge. And as a matter of fact, I'll be working on a tag, okay, to put on us a pin and say common law grand jury. Anybody willing to put that tag on, we should be sitting there with that. We should be sitting there with pens and paper making notes as the judge, especially as the judge speaks, because intimidation at this point is the key thing. And we will threaten the judge to move this. In fact, we will have the papers in our back pocket, so to speak, to move to federal court for cause should this judge try to make any decisions that day at all. or even tell us that he's going to make it. I'll make a decision in 2 weeks or whatever the case. No, at that point we serve the papers, end of subject. We go on the federal court for cause, and then we'll go back to the state court for the case. So that's kind of the plan on that. So we're going to need everyone's help. This is an important case. If we can pull this off, we're looking at $4 billion. We would be putting a lot of people to work at that point, because we can get a lot more work going, a lot more things going, if we have people working full-time that is producing production of the services and the things we're doing. So it'll really be helpful to win this case. With that, back to you. And let's make sure that when you push the button, make sure that Brent has the ability to unmute himself.
Well, he's up on the top. I can unmute him.
But when you push that button for the next person, he's going to fall away.
He's going to go away, okay.
Yeah, so Terry, if you can find Brent after he pushes the button, make sure he's unmuted, and then Brent can mute himself from his own computer. Mute and unmute himself accordingly. But go ahead, Gerard.
I was going to say, let's not forget the nasty little tricks they like to play with us when we go to court of changing the rules. Oh, there you go.
Okay.
So that all the people don't get to the courtroom. Remember they did that to us last time?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, look, when you go to move to the next person, instead of clicking next person or next,
yeah,
click,
just go click
the phone or something next to them, yeah.
Yep. Okay. Just.
So, did you want me to leave my remarks about them walking behind you?
About the what?
Walking behind you.
I don't know if that's meant to be an open mic or not.
I guess I did it.
So click for the next person. I'll make sure that we can.
Okay. We got Anthony from West Virginia. Go ahead, Anthony. You are unmuted.
And you're still unmuted, Brent, so you might want to mute yourself and you're able to talk now. But go ahead, Anthony.
I don't hear anything from Anthony. Anthony from West Virginia, you've been unmuted.
304 area code.
He's been in there a long time. I think he was in there from the beginning, so he might have walked away or something. Going once, twice.
Anthony, West Virginia, last call. All right.
Well, get back in if you get back. Okay, we're going to go to Deb. Deb, I don't know from where.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes. What state?
Deb, what state are you calling from?
Illinois.
Illinois, okay. The great state of Illinois. What's up, Deb?
I'm a brand new member, and what I have been harassed unrelentlessly by people who built a subdivision next to my farm, and surprise, surprise, don't like farm animals. Yeah. And
well,
they happen to be the quote-unquote elite of the county.
Well.
So I have been in court for over 7 years.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Only in Illinois can that happen.
Yeah.
Well, actually that happens everywhere. So.
Well, let me tell you.
I am the only one against whom any charges have ever been brought, even though over $25,000 worth of my livestock has been murdered. My farm has been repeatedly vandalized, my mail stolen, on and on and on.
What county are you in?
I'm in DeKalb County, rural.
And you're in a rural area, generally speaking?
Yes, yes.
Have you spoke with the sheriff?
Yes, I have.
And he's not worth anything, huh?
Well, this last time, they they filed a falsified police report, which I can very easily prove was false, because the state's attorney would not allow any testimony about the police report that they brought me into court on. And I'm like, excuse me? This is the reason I'm here. Why can't I talk about it? Oh, it doesn't apply.
What exactly are they trying to do to you in court, though? What is their focus?
They are saying that my Anatolian Shepherd dogs, which are very intelligent dogs, managed to reach their, in the police report, large dog paws. They are very large dogs, 150 pounds. Through the chain link fence and manipulate the snap lock and get the padlock unlocked with the key that is hung 2 feet away from it on the fence.
Your dog did all this?
Oh, that's what they're saying, yes.
You've got to catch it on camera because you could get rich from that.
Yeah.
Houdini dogs.
And kill two cats without leaving a mark on either cat.
Two cats? C-A-T?
Yes. Two cats from these same people on two separate occasions.
What are they trying to do, though, now?
They're trying to break me, trying to drive me off my
land.
But
so your dog got out and it killed the cat. So what's the
remedy? She's saying that it didn't kill the cat, you know.
It did not kill. The first one I hired a lawyer, big expensive mistake, and I had to guide him through, well, look what it says right here. And I did get the court to reverse that decision once I showed them that there wasn't a mark on the cat.
They're going after you with no vet bills, no pictures of injury or anything like that?
Oh, there's pictures that show there's absolutely no injury to the cat whatsoever.
You can't win a slip and fall case like that for yourself, much less your cat.
Yeah. Well, they won't allow any of the cat testimony in. They're just saying that my dogs managed to get loose and are at large repeatedly. I'm like, you want to show me how they get these locks off?
Just make counterclaims. You know, say, yeah, obviously you guys, if they got out, you let them out yourself.
Are you using a lawyer?
I did for the first case, and he was so useless. And
most of them are. Yeah, most of them are.
I've been doing this all on my own. So what I have done is I have filed and gotten them into default a case against the county and 17 of its agents for violation of their constitutional oath. I have gone through all the process, and I have them in default, and I just contacted my state common law grand jury as to how to proceed with prosecuting this, and I'm wondering how long before we can, do we think, before the CL grand juries are operable.
Well, look, the plan is really to win back the courts. We're in federal court now to win back the courts. And once we do that, then we'll take the state courts over, because as long as we win the case in federal court, the right of the people to have government by consent through free and independent grand and petit juries and other things, but that's the big focus. So once we get through that case, and again, that case is not going to be gotten through until we get to the other side of things. In other words, the deep state is put to bed. And at that point in time, then we will be filling positions immediately in the states and going after every state that rejects or denies abusing the federal courts to leverage our powers and authorities. And we will do that and demand it to be done through summary judgments, okay? And which is lawful in these cases, because they have to rule on the Constitution, so we don't need to go to a jury once we win the main case. The case, main case is going to take a trial jury to do it. But
do
once
you have
we
any
that,
rough idea how long that main case?
Well, wait. Yeah.
But they're, John, they've defaulted, and she needs.
Oh, if they default, you can start. Yeah, definitely get the paper, the default papers, and go get them signed and serve them.
And then
serve
once
them
you,
with. By whom? How?
No, oh. You could get the sheriff to serve him. What do you mean?
Go to the sheriff. Yeah, go. No. Listen. You go
she's
to the clerk.
She's got no choice. You go to the clerk and she stamps him as defaulted because
right.
It's obvious.
You have to write what's called an affidavit of default. You can get an example of that on our website. We have an example on the website. You get the affidavit of default. You fill it out and you go sign it in front of a notary. You take it down to the clerk. And you give it to the clerk. The clerk will then stamp it. They're not to judge it in any way, shape, or form. As long as your wherefore clause or whatever the case may be, if they default it, then it's a default. Once you get that done and it's stamped by the court clerk, you know, from the clerk, then you take it over to the sheriff to serve it on to all of them. You shouldn't have to do that through the sheriff. You should be able to do that by just mailing all of the parties a copy of that.
She's
and
got to get somebody else to mail it, though. She can't do it herself.
Well, I think on that she can. It's the end. It's the case. The only time you need really someone to mail it is if you're making a motion or serving a summons. So all the right. Summons has to be done by someone else. Making a motion has to be done by someone else. But, no, that's a regular judicial process. So once you get the clerk, you can put in the mail. But I would send it to them certified, make sure you get a signature. But if you want, you can have the sheriff serve it onto them, but make sure you get a copy into the court itself and a copy onto, I'd even get a copy to the personally to the judge.
I got a couple of questions.
It's judges, it's the sheriff, it's all the county, they've all, I had the judge look at me and say, well, Mrs. Rock, the Constitution is nice, but it requires case law to back it up.
Yeah, I don't know whether they're that dumb or that evil.
They're that evil. They are that evil.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Totally that
evil. Well, anyway, that's one of the things you could do is what Gerard suggests. And go get your summary judgment that way. If they ignore that at that point, you move it to federal court for court.
That's right. Because that's the only place you can go. And I'll tell you what, if you move it to federal court for cause, file the paperwork, they will, for lack of better language, poop their pants because they don't like that. I mean, if you got a down and out default where they just didn't answer, they have no excuse for that, none, especially since they're the government. And I'm going to tell you, you know, sometimes you're lucky and you get those federal courts are jealous of their power. And when they see a cut and dried thing like this, sometimes they like to slap that lower court. They really do. I mean, Thornton
wonderful,
makes that.
Because
Thornton
it is
that,
absolutely cut and dried.
There's nothing to argue here because, you know, look, they're the government and they have less excuse to default than you do. You know, there's only two reasons that you can default. And they have to be really good reasons. And I don't think they even get the one because they got teams of lawyers. So it's like, what happened? What blew up? You know, who died? I mean, it's like, it's got to be a major, major thing. And then they got to let you know, and they got to try to correct it. Look,
there was absolutely no response from anyone.
They
thought I'm just a silly little woman who will fade away.
Right.
You know, we could also do an amicus curiae for you, okay, and that's done through a joinder where we would send a paper into the court. It's called an amicus curiae on your behalf, and if they fail to respond to that, then we move the case into the federal court for cause, and then we go through the process of giving them opportunity to answer. And when they refuse to answer or whatever the case may be, or even if they do answer, we then come up with a decision in order.
Well, I did this for $34 million. And if you can help me get it done, I will be very generous.
Well, $34 million, you're suing for $34 million?
I sued each agent, both professionally and personally, for $1 million for their
34 of them.
Violation of their constitutional oath.
Well, there's half of that anyway.
Well, $1 million is kind of heavy, but...
Everybody has $1 million liability policy today, John.
Yeah, but yeah. That's a lot of money for...
It's called an umbrella policy.
It is true that she's been damaged for 7 years and...
They should carry $1 million. That's not that much today.
But what I would do, look at, well, maybe it's too late to do... Well, it's never too late. You can do what you want, but I would do it in silver dollars, but not $1 million silver dollars.
Yes. I did think about putting it in there that it had to be constitutional funds, which is silver or gold.
Right, but $1 million in silver is $14 million, maybe 15.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So each one is $15 million. You got to think this out. You got to be reasonably realistic. I mean, look at if you were in jail for 7 years, no doubt $1 million apiece. No doubt that's good.
I have been in jail. It has destroyed my business.
How much time did you spend in jail?
In the jail of life. It has destroyed my business. It has destroyed my personal relationships. It has killed so many of my very valuable animals. It has been 7 years of my life absolutely devoted to worrying about this. There has been nothing. I haven't gone anywhere, haven't been able to do anything because...
All right, well, look, it sounds like you can list out quite a bit of damages and maybe you can justify $1 million.
Yeah, physical and emotional.
But just to say that it is a lot of money, though, but I understand. And we're suing for $4 billion. But look,
that's a lot of money.
Yeah, but we're suing for all the people. Everybody's been damaged. Every person in the United States has been damaged. No matter what side you're on, you've been damaged by these people.
And each corporation has multi-billions of trillions of dollars between them all. So
yeah, they got a trillion between them all, yeah.
But Deb, anyway, I got to ask you something. We got to get going, but quick. I want to know, are you part of the Department of Agriculture, and what other animals besides that? Do you have actual, like, cattle and horses there?
I had everything but cattle and pigs. I have horses. I have animals.
Horses are good.
Yes.
Chickens are good. Let me tell you something. I was on a town board here, and this is a rural area that city people moved up into, and they'll move next door to a farm, and then after they get there, they start complaining to the town board. They can't stand the smell and blah, blah, blah. We had one guy that ran for town office because he has an oil company, but he was farming pigs. He has 200 acres or something, and he put the pigs out there, and they didn't like it on the field because in the next lot they had this housing development. Somebody divided it, and the one woman claimed that she got MRSA from the pigs across the field and all this crazy stuff. So I've heard it all, but the thing that gets them – that makes them fall on their faces. If you're registered as a farm and you're part of the agriculture department, let me tell you what, they fight very hard for farms. And I don't know if you have a right to farm state or not. That makes a difference, too.
Yes, that's how it started getting so vicious. They were sending the sheriff to my door almost every day.
But the agriculture department should have stuck up for you. If it's a right to farm state, they came over here and they told the people, it doesn't matter what the smell is. It was there before you were there. Get used to it.
Well, and not only that, if they wanted to get rid of the smell, all they have to do is plant the proper vegetation, trees, shrubbery, or whatever. Eventually,
planted 6 to 10 foot wide trees and shrubs on the side to try and mitigate everything.
Right, and they should have been the ones doing it. But I appreciate that, of course.
So anyway. That was just another sidebar suggestion that you make sure you join those organizations, and they're pretty good at defending farmers because they've been farmers are attacked.
But we do have to move on in a minute.
The problem here in DeKalb County is these quote-unquote elite are all big-time farmers, and they own.
Brent, can you mute your mic?
They own the entire Farm Bureau here.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because maybe they have some influence in there, and that's why they're not
oh,
sticking up.
Oh, they have huge influence.
Right.
That's
yeah,
the
that's
sheriff. When I filed a report for a false police report, he said, "Well, there's really nothing we can do if somebody just chooses to lie to us."
That's
so,
not true.
Exactly. I copied.
If they know
the
who
law.
It is, that's look at you filing a false police report. I believe
it's
at least
felony.
A misdemeanor or a felony. That's right.
It's a felony. And I sent him a letter recently, and I copied it to good old Governor Pritzker and the Attorney General and all my senators and all my representatives, stating that I was most happy to help the sheriff with his job, since he had told me that there was nothing he could do in this case. Here is the law. Here is the suggested sentencing. And please, I mean, it was four pages. Please, those to whom I have copied this and myself will gladly await your response. There has been none.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're never going to respond. They don't want to work.
No.
So anyway, I think the thing that would wake them up is seeing it go into federal court. Get the default, register the default, and at some point they may wake up. And when you register that default, they're probably not even expecting that. They figure they didn't answer you.
So the affidavit of default is available on your website.
Right, and then bring it to the clerk and let her stamp it. She does not have to talk to the judge. Look, you got your paperwork. She could see you put it in. She could see that there's no answer in the court. The answer has to be in the court, registered, stamped, and would have had to serve their answer on you. So the clerk knows that they're in default right there. And she doesn't need to ask the judge. She needs to do her job, okay?
Okay.
If you look at your browser, you'll see I highlight under education is court forms, process, and instructions. And in here, you should find information how to move your case.
Okay.
Clause,
wonderful.
And
wonderful.
Things. Now, you do have to be a premier member to get to this particular page. There's only a few pages you have to be a premier member for. And a premier member is someone who's given $5 a month or more, so it's not a lot of money. Excuse me?
I just signed up for 10 a month, so...
Oh, that's better.
we'll and, send you double coffee stuff.
Yeah. Woo-hoo.
But anyway, we do need to pay the bills here, so that's why we have to charge something.
Very generous.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to move on now. And
thank
let us
you.
Keep us updated. Come back next week or the week after, whenever you...
I absolutely will.
Okay.
I will call... Gary called me from Northern Illinois the other day and got me going, and I will stay in touch.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have Heather Lee, excuse me, from, what is that, MI, Michigan.
Yes. Am I unmuted?
You are. I recognize your voice. How are you doing, Heather Lee?
Very good. I just have a question for John and you, Gerard. This is something that I just it dawned on me when I was looking at listening to something. It's a question. Why does not NLA present the cases, the joinder of all the cases, seeing that we have a Judge Kahn, who's a con man, who has dug his donkey feet into the ground? Why can't we just walk over the top of that donkey and go into one of the 140-some judges, constitutional judges, that President Trump put in place? I got the list, and there are quite a few of them throughout New York.
Does your list does tell the states? Well, get that list to us. We'll take a look at that and consider how we might be able to get something before those judges.
They just replaced a judge in New York recently, and there's a federal judge under investigation for corruption. There's a lot of stuff going on this week. It's really, the pot's really starting to bubble.
And in that, I'm thinking that we can still indict that sucker. We can still indict Khan. No problem. We can still take him to task and everything else. But the thing is we can also at the same time walk over the top of his arrogance and write into a constitutionally set up judge by the President of the United States appointed in the Constitution and get somewhere with our cases and get them through. It would be a tremendous victory, of course. And why aren't we using, you know, President Trump's, you know, already what he has already done and put in place. And I do have that. I thought I sent, Gerard, I think I sent that to you. I don't know that I sent it to John, but if you look in your email, okay. That list is in there. I found it in Wikipedia, and they're all laid out.
You sent it to Gerard at National Liberty Alliance?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll take a look at the list, see if we can do something with it. But one of the problems is we're not looking for a judge to make a decision other than, of course, a summary judgment on our behalf, which is what they need to do, okay? But really, it's the people. It's a common law court that we've opened, and it's the people who must really decide unless – and again, if it's a federal judge, they are – look, if you move a case to a federal court for cause, which means that there's a constitutional violation, particularly in our case, one of our unalienable rights that's listed in the Bill of Rights, and it doesn't have to be listed there, but it's moved for cause, for the violation of a right. And usually it's moved because of denial of due process and also, you know, hijacking the court and moving us into jurisdictions unknown and numerous things. And it is clear on the paper and what, you know, it is absolutely clear. If you read the paper, it's clear. And so the judge does have a duty to do summary judgments in those cases on behalf of, and that's why you move it to federal court for that judge to make that simple decision and order. It's very simple. They cannot be ruling on the other side, and they cannot be ruling against us unless we didn't prove the fact that they don't have jurisdiction, and that's very simple to see, unless we didn't prove the fact that we've been violated in certain ways, unalienable rights and so on. But those things are clear, so they have to rule for us. But they won't, and they don't. But it is interesting to know who those judges are to see if we can We really can't request a particular judge, but it'd be nice to know where we can file it and maybe get one of those judges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could refile it and demand that he recuse himself and withdraw.
Recuse him immediately.
And say, look, this guy needs to be in jail, not on our case, and at the very least you need to do is recuse him and give me another judge, right?
Absolutely.
I'll
send it to you, John, and I've already sent it to Gerard. I'll resend it to you, Gerard, if you want that too.
I'm having trouble with my email. I got to go fix that because I'm not getting a lot of stuff for some reason. I meant to get in there and find out what's going on. I think Terry told me that stuff was coming back, getting bounced back or something.
Okay, and then I also okay. There's also other things that I put in there, and they were in reference to the Department of Justice has a questionnaire, and this is comical to me because it's quite a questionnaire, and it's mandatory that when it's sent to them, they have to fully fill it out and send it in, and it is a questionnaire of foreign entities in the Department of Justice, and they're all foreign entities. They're all bar, except for maybe what President Trump just did with the justices, the constitutional justices. And so I sent that also in the email.
I had heard that that's how they got those judges out. Because
yeah, it's a great, I've used it.
paper file where they didn't have an oath or something.
Because they're all bar. And then there's also a public servant questionnaire that there it's mandatory in their fiduciary duty to fill it completely out and send that in. And then there's a W-9, which scares them half to death.
Right. Because
so anyway, I have those things in the email also, so I'll just send those along. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, we got Greg from Michigan, another Michigan person. Got to straighten up that Michigan. Oh, okay.
Yeah, hi, you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can, yes.
What's that?
Yes, we can, yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if either of you thought that there might have been any foul play involved in Scalia's death. I hear some people I talk with here.
No doubt in my mind.
And would it have been to do with, well, I know the case was many years earlier, but I imagine a lot of people were not too happy about his decision in the, what was it, Williams versus United States case?
Yeah, that's right, and I think he was involved in Sheriff Mack's case. Didn't he make the...
Oh, you know what? You might be right. That was something we had discussed. I don't know, but he's been standing in their way a lot of years on the court, you know, as because, you know, he speaks up. And
yeah.
And I think...
Well, that came to an end suddenly, didn't it?
Yeah, and I, you know, look, you think that if they were going to kill him, they would have killed him a long time ago because he did a lot of stuff after Williams to hurt them. And I think they were trying to get something on him, you know, because there was some wild parties going over there, and he probably didn't bite. And so they said, the heck with this, and they found him with a pillow over his face. That's probably how they killed him, you know. But, and then they didn't do an autopsy. There was all kinds of fugazi stuff around the procedure and the cause of death. I think they even cremated him, if I'm not mistaken, right away, so... They made sure that nothing could be found out. I mean, what could be more suspicious?
Yeah, I've heard conflicting information on his cremation and not cremation, so I don't know.
Somebody knows, but the thing is, you know, he was already older. He was quite up there. I don't know how many more years he would have been in there. You think they would have tried something else, but... I don't know. You know, the guy did a lot of good for us in the courts and certainly stood up as much as he could, as much as any one man can, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and it's a shame. So now he's gone. But,
Yep. And these two other...
I was also...
They're not so good either, but anyway, go ahead.
I was wanting some clarification on something. You know, I talked with... I don't know if you recall me mentioning this group that I have been meeting with here for a couple years. The names John Tater and Ron Sasek, because they remember talking with you guys years ago. I guess it was several years ago before I got involved with their group. But they've said, well, we've looked at the Williams versus U.S. Case and... we just, you know, and we don't find any evidence, any constitutional evidence that supports the idea of legitimacy of the grand juries. And I don't know more details than that. However, if I remember from weeks back, didn't one of you say something where the basis for Williams versus U.S. being supportive or maybe just the legitimacy of the grand juries itself without reference to that case, but in regards to reference to the U.S. Constitution, that actually you said the basis for its legitimacy of the grand juries was found in the Declaration of Independence and not the Constitution, or did I hear you incorrectly?
No, it's founded in the Bill of Rights to begin with, but look at the foundation of our law. Is found there in the Declaration of Independence. And just look at the grand jury is a common law instrument of the people. It is the people. How can you bridle the people? How can you decide who the people will be. How can you deny other people from bringing to the common law grand jury anything that they want to bring? How can you deny the sheriff access to the grand jury? How can, look at everything they're doing is illegal. Just think about this. They have no power, no authority, and no business being in a court of law. Okay? If they're a judge and they're sitting in a court of law, they have to wear their magistrate cap because every judge is a magistrate. Okay? You've got the powers of a magistrate. So that's an administrator of justice. And in the case of a magistrate, they don't get to decide anything. They keep things going. They act as a traffic cop in a court of law. They make sure each side is appropriate and moves forward and everything is fair and moves forward. But at the end of the day, the will of the jury must be applied, and the administrator, which is the magistrate, because the administrator of that court, he's supposed to sign the paper, which is the will, and seal it, which is the will of the people through the grand jury, and then move it over through the system, which usually go to the sheriff for enforcement or whatever type of enforcement needs to be applied at that point. And then things move forward. But the United States versus William paper is very, very, very clear, okay? We're looking at it right now. Anybody who's looking on their browser here, it says here, rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, and this is written by Scalia, and he's got a lot of referrals to a lot of court.
Everything is footnoted and referred. It's not even his opinion. It's the Supreme Court's opinion.
He's brought all of the past up and put it into one paper.
How could you say there's nothing there? It's one of the most powerful papers I've ever read.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
You know, I don't know that. Greg, have you gone through it and read it and read the footnotes?
No, I have not, and I want to. I only know that's what they said, and they were very dismissive of it having any relevance or being any legal basis.
Was there any bio attorneys involved with them?
Yeah. Stop.
I don't know. They don't speak any better of attorneys than you guys do. No.
Okay.
No.
Are they the man on the land stuff?
What's that?
Do they get involved with a lot of the stuff, the man on the land, you know, filing judgments, what do they call it?
It's mostly like UCC stuff, but it's kind of like a version of that, the man on the land stuff, you know. And they're the ones that usually end up getting in trouble because they put liens on and
they'll file a lien without giving the judge due process, things like that.
No, I don't think so. They have filed a number of cases, basically challenging, statutes, as opposed to being. Constitutional law and that kind of thing around here, around the Detroit area. A lot of it's over, say, ordinance violations or traffic tickets or that kind of thing. They wrote a lot of defense for me in my case here against Redford and the ordinance department and the court screwing me over, which you may remember me talking about that happened a couple of years ago. The court just totally ignored them, and it was no fault of theirs. They cited a lot of constitutional case law and all that. The court simply chose just to ignore it. And when I got an attorney later who cited more about statutes and the Michigan Constitution and all, which these courts seem to prefer, you know, they simply ignored everything he presented as well. They didn't acknowledge the validity of it.
They comfort themselves on the fact that you went into their court and they have jurisdiction over you and they don't have to give you anything in the Constitution.
Well, right, and again, I don't know if you recall, but I've mentioned before, they emptied the courtroom out most of the time before they had my hearings holding my case for last.
That's unlawful.
They held my case for last over and over so that I was the only one there.
They do that to us over here, too, but, you know, that's why we have court watchers. Because they can't actually empty the courtroom. What they do is they try to run it so that it's overtime, and then they extend it. So if it's overtime, everybody's usually gone. You know what I mean?
I had people go with me at different times. Once I just had a friend to go, and it was just her and I left in the courtroom at the end, and they realized she was with me, and they basically chased her out. They made her leave. And then they put the scare in her. They were wanting to see her driver's license and all that stuff. And, you know, and she was only there to be with me. She didn't have any case or anything of her own. But they got rid of her, and then they write falsified transcripts and that kind of thing.
To hide any
incriminating.
That's why you need to go in with a bunch of people, because they might do that with one person, but they certainly won't do it with 10.
I did once toward the end, because they took me to court about 9 times in a 12-month period. They had me going to court about every 6 weeks or so for a solid year. And in one of the cases, I had about, I don't know, a half a dozen people from our group went. And everybody in my group was in an uproar with how that the judge dealt with me, and she didn't care. And a number of them wrote letters to the Judicial Tenure Commission in Detroit, and, you know, they all got a response that they found nothing to investigate and the case was closed, but thanks for bringing it to our attention. But, you know, if you haven't heard, Michigan is known to be very, very corrupt in this regard, and more so than most other states.
Yeah, it's because they all have trump cards on each other. You know, they all know what the other guy did to him. You know, it's like being made in the mob. And they're comfortable because they know that other person is not going to do anything to them because they got the goods on that one. That's how they hold the whole system together. You know what I mean? So
this seems to be a very traditional thing here. And these judges here seem to know that they're not going to be disciplined by the JTC or the Attorney General or Governor, and people have, including myself, have conveyed things to the Attorney General's office and Governor's office. They often don't even respond. They don't even give any response. And I know other people who have experienced the same thing. But so regarding the Williams versus United States and then the basis for the grand juries, you say that's more in the Declaration of Independence and in the Bill of Rights more so than the Constitution itself. Is that correct?
That's right. It's in the Bill of Rights in the Fifth Amendment, and it's in the Declaration of Independence, and it's in the Magna Carta, which we
the key thing, and everybody, and they all recognize the Magna Carta. As a matter of fact, if you read a lot of their stuff with their books, when they talk about the grand jury, they refer to the Magna Carta themselves, and still yet they get the number wrong. The Magna Carta is clear, it's 25 people. But we did do a paper, we've done lots of papers, almost all the papers we do, we give authorities and of the grand jury. And so you can go to our website, let me see, up here on nationallibertyalliance.org, under grand jury, highlight grand jury and come down and click on action against the judiciary. And if you read some of these cases and papers we have, we give a lot of information concerning the power and the authority of the grand jury. We've done memorandums also, jury nullification, jury tampering and stacking, the difference between law and equity. So there's a lot of memorandums up here which will school you in particular subject matters. And again, let's just take any of our cases. We always put in the facts of the authority. For instance, in this decision and order, which I'm going to pop open right now, it's a 57-page paper. But even in here, we have an area. Let's see, a letter, memorandum, just the documents, just the decision and order. Should be in here somewhere, the power and the authorities. And we give a lot of information on this. They can't defeat our paperwork. The only thing they could do is throw us out because they just can't respond to our paperwork. And it's clear.
Well, I'll have to look into it more. I'll mention,
yeah, right
too,
here.
Alex.
Grand
you guys.
Jury, look at this. The grand jury is paramount. To page 5, okay? So if you go up here on this paper, which is a decision and order on that page, and you come down to page 5, see if we can get to it and just look at it just a little bit. It's 2, 3, 4, should be 5 now, I think. Here it is. The grand jury is paramount. Supreme Court, in the case of Schneckloth and Bustamante, Okay, confirmed that even the United States Supreme Court could not second-guess the jury. Now, this is talking about the trial jury, of course. Writing, the judgment of a court of record whose jurisdiction is final is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this, the United States Supreme Court, would be. It is as conclusive on this court, the United States Supreme Court, as it is on other courts. It puts an end to the inquiry concerning the facts by deciding it. Inferior courts are those whose jurisdictions are limited and special and whose proceedings are not according to the course of the common law. And it goes on here, the grand jury is one of the ways that we the people consent to the actions of our government. If anyone has been deprived of their unalienable rights, we will immediately grant full justice therein. The will of the grand jury is the opening and the manifestation of due process in a court of law. The grand juries is the sureties of the peace that we find in the Magna Carta and was ordained by we the people through the Fifth Amendment and thereby officially acknowledged as an unalienable right. They are the posterity of our founding fathers. They are we the people that ordained and established the Constitution for the defendants. Failure to obey the law will result in this matter that has already been brought before the grand jury that previously decided mercy via correction first by way of this court of record, decisions and orders and writs and indictments for those who continue in denial and resist the will of the people. And it goes on, you know, it tells the grand jury is an institution separate from the courts whose, over whose functioning the courts do not preside. This is United States versus Williams and also some other court cases. The grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, and that's the key. It is not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any. And it cannot be. It could never be. The people don't even have the power to do that because it's a common law process. And the government does not participate in the common law process. And it goes on. It has been not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the government, of the institutional government. It serves as a kind of a buffer or a referee between the government and the people. The grand jury's functional independence from the judicial branch is evident both in the scope of its power to investigate criminal wrongdoing and in the manner in which the power is exercised. Unlike a court whose jurisdiction is predicated upon a specific case of controversy, the grand jury can investigate merely on the suspicion that a law has been violated, or even because it just wants to assure that it is not. Okay, and we got a lot more information. It goes on, talks about the unified United States common law grand jury, who we are, how what we're comprised of, how we came to be, who, how we organized, and on and on and on. So we give a lot of information in all of our papers. You can go in and cut and paste all this stuff you want. The people have been providentially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the judiciary. We the people via the grand jury from December 2016 to present commanded via written quo vantos, informations and written mandamuses to all elected, appointed, and hired servants to obey the law of the land and join the people in our endeavor to reinstate the Constitution for the United States of America and bring to justice all subverters who resist. We, the people, have been providentially entrusted via natural law to dispense justice and were provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the judiciary and our representatives. The people have the unbridled right by law and in law to impanel their own grand juries and present true bills of information, indictments, and presentments to the court of justice, which is then required to commence a criminal proceeding under the natural law. I can go on and on and on. We have put a lot of information, and you can see we've got lots of footnotes. Here is our all of our information, where we get our information from, all of the footnotes. It's pretty powerful. They can't answer any of this stuff.
I just want to say that a lot of times with these groups, these lawyer groups and these law groups, they get bad habits of depending on those publications that do the Reader's Digest condensed version. So if you told them U.S. versus Williams, they'll go into this book, this condensed book, and they'll look it up, and it'll get some other attorney's opinion of what that case meant. And usually that guy's a communist. Okay, it didn't mean anything. Nothing here. You know what I mean? And I guarantee you they didn't read the case themselves, because most of what John just read, I mean, that was in our case, but a lot of it came out of U.S. versus Williams. And how could you read that and not understand what it means? And it's by no means boring. I don't care. I mean, that's pretty interesting stuff, I think.
Oh, it did sound pretty clear to me as well. It wasn't that hard to understand.
If it's not clear to them, then they need to, like, go to a doctor or go out of that business. You know, I mean,
let me tell you, I think the key point to these things is that very fact. Common law is clear. It is common sense. It is, it's a truth that you can't deny. When you read and hear these things, how can you deny them anyway? Okay? Common law, in a court of law, everything should be in plain language. Jefferson spoke about this. That is plain language, you know. When you get language that's difficult to understand, that is so constructive, you got to go here and look in here and then dig down this rabbit hole there and lay this upon that and do all this construction of law, which plays a role, by the way, but it gets so convoluted, it gets so confusing that you don't know what they're even talking about after a while. I mean, you got to really dig deep and pay attention, and it's all, you know, legalese. It's just lost. But common law is plain and clear and makes common sense, and you cannot deny it. And it has a foundation in our law, in our Constitution, in our Bill of Rights, in our Declaration of Independence, the maxims of law, which there are thousands and thousands of maxims. I mean, it's undeniable. You can't deny it. No court should or can deny it. If they did, they're unjust.
Didn't you guys say some people had been arrested for trying to get sheriffs to forward something to a grand jury for them?
No.
There was a guy that was trying to get help from us. The problem was he wasn't receiving.
He didn't get a sheriff to do it. He did it himself, didn't he?
Yeah, he did it himself. But they got him. He probably went to the sheriff too, though. But he was arrested and he got 2 years for. They said he was what do they call
tampering.
It? No, not tampering, but when you
stalking
the grand jury. I mean, he's trying to see the grand jury. They get him for stalking, and they got away with it, and they convicted him on it. People, I think we could have done a lot for this guy, but he didn't listen close enough. He wanted to add or do different things, and we never got anywhere really to help him.
He was one of those guys that Samuel Clements wrote about, because he says, it's not what you don't know that gets you, it's what you think you know that ain't so to get you. And that's kind of what his problem was. He thought that he knew so much. He didn't want to do what we said, and he ended up going to jail. And, you know, we've told other people in the past, if you do that, you're going to jail, and they go to jail. And it's not because we're psychic. It's because 1 and 1 equals 2. That's why. But anyway, we got
to know what they do.
Yeah. We've been on for like 15 minutes, and I got
three. Yeah, all right, fellas. Well, thank you very much. I will look into it more on your site, and thank you.
Yeah, can't hurt. Read the stuff. It's really good. Anyway.
No, I'm sure it is. I will.
Okay.
Thanks again.
You're welcome. Okay, Enrique, let's go from Carolinas. No, I mean Enrique from California. Excuse me.
Yeah, hello. Hey, I just want to throw a little joke about the dogs. They're pretty smart, but if people just get their cameras out and film, stroll back and let them go, they can just stroll back in the yard and lock the gate behind them and aim the key up. I mean, if they're really that smart, they'd be able to pull that off too. Anyways, what I wanted to mention is Attorney General Barr. He said something yesterday that was very interesting. He said that it's well known that, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but the gist of it was, it's well known that the grand juries have been non-existent for quite some time now.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah.
I heard some other good things. I didn't hear that. There's been I'll tell you, this has been a bombshell.
I smiled. I was like, that's what I'm talking about, the grand jury. That's us, brother. That's us.
Maybe we woke them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he said they're non-existent. He didn't say basically. He said they are, I'm not quoting exactly, but it's a fact that there are no, there have been no grand juries for quite some time. And that's not an exact quote, but that's pretty close.
Right, right. And that means
so
that's
that
on
that's
their mind, right? Well, there's a lot of places that don't use grand juries, and one of the ways that they get people before they even have an indictment or anything, they'll bring the person in and they'll tell them what they got on them, and then they'll have them plead down to something else even before they charge them, which is, I think that's illegal as all heck, but they do
well,
it.
Well, that's kind of constitutional, a little due process. I mean, he doesn't get the face of the accuser, but at least he gets to go in there and get some sort of due process, right?
You would think.
I mean, as far as an affidavit and affirmation, Article 1, Section 9, Column 2, writ habeas corpus, at least he gets that. You know, that's what they demand.
They make themselves feel good because once you sign something or say something, you know, that's why you should go to court and open your mouth up, because you don't know what jurisdiction you just put yourself in. And the minute you admit to or whatever, you just gave up your rights. I mean, you can give up your rights to the Fifth Amendment of incriminating yourself by talking, and nobody can stop you from doing that. I mean, the only thing is they're supposed to inform you of that right, and now they're saying you don't get it if you don't proclaim it. That was the latest thing they did, you know.
Well, isn't it a Sixth Amendment? You have to know the nation, origin of their jurisdiction. It goes to that we need to get to the point where we have clarification for remedy, you know, clarification of remedy,
right.
Clarification of whatever is it, you know, what is the reason for it? What is, you know, where is it? The damaged party? One that goes right to the beginning, right to the source.
The
man, the woman.
Well, look, the more people that pay attention and educate themselves, which knowledge, which is power, you know, and eventually, you know, you get what John says, is which is like critical mass. And then if some of those people start drawing the lines between that knowledge, they actually get wisdom. So there's hope. You know,
and
there's hope.
Philosophy is lover of wisdom. That's right. Philosophy. Then next step is philosopher, lover of wisdom.
Right. But
right.
Look at. That's where we got to go. Anyway, thank you, Enrique. Appreciate that.
Thank you, my brother.
Yeah.
Thank you, brothers and sisters. Much love.
Yeah. God bless. Okay. I got, real quick, I got Dan from the Carolinas. We're a couple minutes over, but go ahead, Dan.
Greetings. We had, about 2 weeks ago, this dear lady just really, we didn't have much time, but Mr. Gerard, you were trying to comfort her, and I know you did follow up with her. You know the lady. I won't try to call her name. I don't really know it as well as you would. Several things came as to struck a note with me. I'm dealing with something very similar, almost identical in some areas. And I hope this lady's hearing. One thing is this. there can be a disclaimer statement that rejects a legal claim, or excuse me, a legal assumed. I better put the assumed claim. Mm. And this would be like a municipality or a county seat or a tax department, etc. And it probably could be used even against certain mortgage situations, but I won't go that far right now. But try to make this simple. A disclaimer for against property tax are that there are no constitutional foundation in law by our Supreme Court, meaning there are no Articles of Federation within our Constitution authorizing said taxation. So I hope that lady is, staying in tune with you guys, because I know you guys know this better than even I do. And would, of course, take a remedy for her, a recourse in law, where that clearly she's being violated of her due process of law.
If it's who I think it is, they put a false mortgage on her and then foreclosed. That's what they did. It was a group of attorneys, and they're evil.
Yes, sir.
and they steal properties. And it wasn't to look at as far as land tax goes. The way to get around it is they put your property down as commercial, and so the government does have jurisdiction over commercial stuff. They can tax it. But, you know, when they start calling you a tenant on the land and all this other baloney, and then they're going to come after you in rem, they think they got it pretty well knocked up, you know, with their terminology. And I guess if you don't go in there and rebut the presumption, which I've done, it didn't make any difference. Well, they kind of fooled me on mine. They scared us into paying. They said, well, if you don't pay, we're gonna convert the deed, and then you won't be able to fight it. You should just pay and come back and fight it later. So we paid it because I didn't want them to take my property, because that's what they do, and they put it right on the auction block. And so once I paid it, you know, the attorney for the county got with the judge and said, you got to dismiss this because the point's moot. The taxes have been paid. I should have known better. You know,
what might help that lady? I heard what you said just a few minutes ago. She needs to also pay attention to the status of the property there. If she is using that for a homestead and she's not leasing any room out or anything on a commercial basis, it's clearly not commercial, and that would move away from that notion in law. Something I'd like to bring up that I've just discovered just recently, and this has made a revelation. I couldn't wait to kind of try to get some of this information over. Mr. Chan does have a battery or log, I guess, of about 20 different takes on law, and I won't try to be, you know, cover 20 takes here because we don't have much time. But I will tell you this. Guys, I discovered, and I hope this lady is hearing, what is a forged deed, which becomes a forgery deed, and it automatically comes with a situation in law. If someone was to prepare it right now, whether they put it on the public record in the register of deeds or not, it doesn't matter. It is immediately void. You don't have to void. It's not voidable. That means you don't have to go in the process in a courtroom to prove that, you know, it's void. It's already void on the face of it, and does have no merit whatsoever, and cannot convey to anyone by instrument that property that would belong to that lady. So forged documents is some things that this lady will want to look into. Fraudulent documents and falsifying the public records, those are absolutely felonies, and this is being done in some of my cases, obscuring the county record of register of deeds, and also in the tax department and revenue department in this same county. The same thing's going on, and I got a showdown with the county attorney and the county manager, and so I've got a revelation that they don't know it, that, and I'll say this real quickly. My brother, as you know, forged documents, and it became a forged power of attorney because my mother wasn't competent at the time, and he also used it in a case, and he committed perjury. There's a string of felonies within that instrument that my brother did. Now, I'm trying to tell you all the good news is that transcript that I mentioned back in time where the county tried to steal our property, my mother's homestead, and my homestead by inheritance, which is I'm talking for tonight in closing. I'm telling you, my brother has no clue, but that transcript is being recorded in the register of deeds. They cannot strike it down, and it's his own admission inside of that transcript is a revelation of found discoveries for a string of felonies up in the millions and millions. You've heard this before, and assets and actual properties, and so that document's on register. and I let that county know that admission is going to have to be dealt with, and that the county is going to have to extract from the record what has been a public nuisance by my brother, putting all these properties in there and belonging to him when in fact he had no authority. And so he's going to be charged with actually practicing law without a license, and he's going to be charged for public nuisance and fraud. And I mean, public nuisance is minor, but compared to the officials who are caught up there of housing actual purported looking deeds that are, as I've just described, are totally bogus and void, whether they were registered or not, on the face of them. And in closing, the county, I say again, is caught up in where that they knew ahead of time that what they were allowing in their records, because we've been battling with them for some time, and so they now are caught up in what the clerks can be charged as felonies. Not only my brother falsifying, because the North Carolina, in closing, North Carolina General Assembly states laws that have to do that a registrar such in Brunswick County has to abide by. And I know the statutes, and I've got the total documents and everything, what would suffice, what would be the criteria before any kind of deed can be put on record. And so none of those, thank the good Lord, that I've told you guys about, none of them won't even meet the North Carolina General Assembly's laws of what the entry and the criteria of those documents have to be on their face.
Well,
so I know that was a little lengthy. But
I'm going to have her pull the tape up of tonight and listen to it. Because
yes, sir. And I just hope that lady will maybe pay some of this, have a little sense that we're behind her, and that, no question about it, lady, you stay in touch with National Liberty Alliance, with Mr. John Durash and Gerard and all the others there, because you there's fraud in your case. And I will say this in closing. I want to encourage all people to hear this, that soon, it won't be long, before all litigants will be able to go in these 3,133 counties where this criminal, what I call criminal enterprise or lack of due process of law, schemes, color of law, whatever you want to call it, hocus pocus, machinery that's going on against you, we the people, you the citizen, I guarantee you it's not very far around before you'll be able to walk in one of those courts, that's the defense, you'll request for that judge to provide you with his oath of office, and immediately right on the same nickel, you make him prove that he's got jurisdiction in law and that you're there for jurisprudence according to a court of record. And if it's not a court of record, you don't even have to show up, really. I mean, John Durash will tell you this, all of it. You don't even have to. You file documents. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Okay. I hope that'll be some help.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. It's 12:15. I'm turning into a pumpkin here. So... same time next week. God bless. Keep your powder dry and keep your nose up because there's stuff going on. We'll pick up next week where we left off here. Good show, people. Thanks.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night. Let me shut this recording.